Aquaman and Superman, Animal Man and Plastic Man, Firestorm and Nuclear Man, Batman and Hawkman, 2D Man and Hour Man.
Who are all these people, man?
They're all part of the DC. Who's who? Ultra Boy and Booster Gold, Lightning Lass and Hippolyta, Phantom Stranger, Etric and Arisia and Woozy Winks.
Hey.
What?
What about that one guy?
What guy?
Mr. Pretzel, Mr. Lipstick, Mr. Mitzelfuzzle?
Mr. Mitzi's Pitlick?
Yeah, him.
He's also part of the DC. Who's who?
Hello, and welcome to the Who's Who, the definitive podcast of the DC Universe, covering Who's Who Update 1993, number 2, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm one of your hosts, the Irredeemable Shag, and along with me is my co-host, the esteemed Rob Kelly. And we are here in a pretty momentous occasion, Rob, wouldn't you say?
12 years. It's been 12 years since we started this show.
And to be specific, it's been 12 years since we started the mission. Our mission statement was to cover all of the DC superhero Who's Who comics. And as of today, we will have accomplished, as long as Rob and I don't kill each other before we're done, we will have accomplished that mission after 12 years. Mission accomplished, buddy.
Got the banner behind me. I'm very excited. Yes, I can't. I'm trying to think of those fresh-faced fools in 2011 who sat down and cracked open the first Who's Who and started talking about the ABLE listing.
Yeah,
we would still be doing this.
We recorded it three times, by the way.
2023, we'd still be talking about this stuff, but here we are. You know, we show commitment to the bit.
Yeah.
Give us that, everybody. We are not quitters.
Now, before Frank even gets started typing, although I'm probably too late.
Yeah, he probably already sent this. Yeah.
Right. It's not over, folks. We've said it every episode for a long time. Even though we have mission accomplished on the original mission, the mission parameters have expanded. You know, scope creep, if you've ever done project management. You know, we want to cover a lot more than just that. So, yes, obviously we're going to do Impact. No, it will not be the last thing we do. We're going to do the Mayfair game supplements. We're going to continue to do more of Who's That, where we do deep dives into characters, which, by the way, I've got one in the works for a really obscure character that I'm super excited about. We're going to do more flashback compilations where, you know, we're like we did the Titans one, or we did the Wonder Woman one, you know, things like that, Aquaman one. And, you know, we've got other surprises as well, because this show is too much fun to let it end. And the fact that you and I were talking about this the other day with the network is, honestly, more than any other show on our network, this show is what created the Fire and Water Podcast Network. That's fair to say, right?
That's completely fair. That is a completely accurate statement in terms of it drew the most comments. Again, I've said this multiple times on this show that I never would have guessed this thing would have, within relative, you know, the relative framework of the Fire and Water Network and the other shows that we do, this thing would be as popular as it was, because I just thought this was so obscure. It's talking about a series that has been, you know, null and void in continuity for decades. And yet we still get emails from people. We're going to read some of them later on.
Yep.
Who are just discovering the show now. And it's just, it's unbelievable. So, yeah, we do love doing it. Who's That is especially fun. I'm looking forward to your Lord Schilling episode. That's going to be terrific.
nice strike. Keep throwing darts.
as you just mentioned, this is not the end of the show. It's just the end of this particular mission to go through the Who's Who books. Exactly. But, the comments that this show engendered, and then the back and forth between commenters, and the sheer lunacy of some of the comments we got. It really did. And we got to know people that we now hang out with and call our friends and stuff like that. It's pretty amazing.
I spent a lot of time with them at HeroesCon just a week or two ago. So, it's been wonderful. It's been a great thing in our lives, I gotta say. So now looking back, you know, obviously it's been a year since we did the last, you know, official Who's Who issue where we covered an actual issue, but we've given you four issues or four episodes in 2022. We had the update for part one for 93. We had the Who's That on Composite Superman and one on Nightshade, which was a lot of fun because I didn't have to do it with you. And then we did the new Golden Age, which was kind of a surprise, you know, Who's Who entries, new Who's Who entries, which is a lot of fun.
And so, that might still happen, right? Like we were saying this is the last Who's Who book, but there might there was a new Golden Age Who's Who that we didn't expect. So who knows? DC might do more of those. We don't
That's absolutely true. And there have been other Who's Who efforts, you know, like there was, you know, when the New 52 started, they did a Who's Who page in the back of every issue, number zero. Right. You know, we're not going to dig into every New 52 book. Sorry, folks. and then, you know, after Who's Who kind of went away, DC focused their efforts on those DK books. You know, they did a lot of those that you could get, the DC Encyclopedia, you know, the Secret Files and Origins, all that stuff. So we're not going to go into that realm of it. We're going to find other stuff we want to talk about. But either way, it's been a blast, and it's exciting to sort of finish out the original mission statement, but still keep it alive. Well, we've got like 4 hours of recording ahead of us. We should probably get rolling here. What do you think?
I will tell everybody in tribute to the origins of this show, I have not read a single entry in this comic that we're about to talk about.
And I'm going to mispronounce every name. So we're keeping in the spirit of the show.
Classic Rob.
All right, folks. Well, we do need to take a second to thank our sponsor. This episode is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping on orders of $50 or more. Now, I'm going to go first. Normally, I ask Rob to because I cheated and took the most obvious one. Because,
you certainly did.
Well, I mean, come on. The last time we did Who's Who Update 93, there was only the one omnibus of Who's Who. Well, since then, they have published a second volume. So yes, you can get Who's Who Omnibus Volume 2 now on InStock Trades. It covers Who's Who in the Legion, episodes issues 1 through 7, Who's Who in the DC Universe, 1 through 16, and Who's Who in the DC Universe, Update 93, 1 and 2, which we are completing today. Obviously published by DC. Covers by George Perez and Brian Bolland. So one of those kind of mashup covers where they take a bunch of stuff, put it together. Page count is 1,206. That is a hell of a doorstop. Full color, all hardcover. Normally goes for $150, right? Going to break the bank. But you can get it for 42% off, so it's only $87. That's a hell of a steal. So that's a really, really good deal. So since I cheated, Rob, what'd you bring?
Okay. Well, based on my favorite listing from this issue of Who's Who, I chose Dark Stars Omnibus Edition, Volume 1. No, of course not. No, I went with Crisis on Multiple Earths. Trade paperback, book 2, Crisis Crossed. I know it's Crisis Crossed. I just felt like saying it like Chris. Crisis Crossed. This reprints all the JLA JSA team-ups from Justice League of America, issues 91 through 92, and basically all the team-ups through 159 through 160. So all the yearly.
How fun.
All the yearly teams, right. So you've got stories by Carrie Bates, Lynn Wein, E. Nelson Bridwell, Paul Levitz, art by Dick Dillon, of course, Frank McLaughlin, Joe Giella, Dick Giordano. The cover features Superman and Shazam about to beat the crap out of each other.
Yeah.
It's that infamous two-parter where a bunch of Fawcett characters appeared that DC didn't even have the rights to, and they didn't bother to check. They just did it. Fantastic. I love comics used to do it that way. This is not a Who's Who omnibus level page count, but still, it's a big book, 416 pages.
Wow.
Of JLA JSA team ups. Can't beat that. Normal price, $39.99. In stock trades price, $23.19. You save 42% off. So look, as a kid, everyone knows I love Justice League of America. It's my favorite comic of all time. I never missed it. And these yearly team ups were just some of the most fun stories. So it's great to have a bunch of them collected here in Crisis on Multiple Earths, book 2.
Oh, that's so good. I'm glad they're doing those trades again. The Crisis on Multiple Earths trades were always some of my favorites. So that's great. So folks, for these and all your other trade paperback needs, please visit InStockTrades.com. Now, this episode is also sponsored in part with your support through our Patreon. Because, you know, running the Fire Order Podcast Network with so many shows requires a whole lot of online hosting and other services. And a while back, we realized we needed some help with the expenses. And we launched the Patreon, and you folks really stepped up to help us keep the network going. So if you're enjoying the Who's Who podcast, the best way to support the show is by visiting our Patreon. What's that Patreon, Rob?
Patreon.com/FW Podcast.
And while you're there, please consider supporting the network. And in certain tiers, you'll get mentioned on your show of choice, just like these folks who asked to be recognized on the Who's Who podcast. So our thanks go out to
Chuck Coletta, Corey Drew, Damian Whiter, David Ace Gutierrez, Gord Tolton, Jeremiah Jones Goldstein,
Michael Atchison, Nathan Archer, Noah Tarnow, Steve Givens, Tom Perrin, and Tom Panarese. Again, folks, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FW Podcasts. All right, so get out on the social medias, tag us. You know, we're FW Podcasts on Twitter, we're Fire and Water Podcast Network on Facebook, and we will put a few of these entries up on our gallery post over on our site, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. The only challenge is you know, when we started the show, we weren't worried about this ever coming back into circulation, right? So we used to post a whole bunch of images. I'm trying to be a little more sparing nowadays that you can actually buy these things in an omnibus form, but we'll post some of them out there. And, yeah, so Rob, you mentioned Dark Stars. Let's talk about them. What do you say?
Oh, God.
So I posted go ahead. What were you saying?
How did they get the cover? Come on.
Well, they thought they were going to be a thing. So we'll save that for the actual entry. But I will say, I posted a teaser that we were going to be doing this show. So I posted what was a picture on my camera roll or something or other. And I put clearly the cover of Who's Who. And I wrote in giant notes, Who's Who podcast notes for update 93, number 2. It says Who's Who podcast right across the top. And like half the comments are like, oh, you like Dark Stars? And I'm like, no. That's not what I'm trying to say at all, but that's okay. All right. So let's see here. This is Who's Who in the DC Universe update 1993, issue number 2. Cover date, January 1993. Shelf date was December 8th, 1992. So I just realized it's false advertising because this says update 1993 and this came out in 92. Lies, all lies.
Arlene Lowe. Damn it.
The cover price is $5.95, which is a lot of money, right? It's a lot of money. Oh, I got a story to tell. Oh, my gosh. Because we put this off long enough. At Heroes Con, I got a chance to talk with none other than Michael Urie. And I got to thank him for Who's Who and talk to him about that for a moment or two. And I brought a Who's Who binder edition, the loose leaf. Issue number 1, still sealed, because I bought an extra set a couple years ago when I was out with Sean Ross shopping, and I brought an extra Who's Who number 1 sealed, opened it in front of him, and had him sign it, and he said, now, this doesn't make any sense to me, but I swear he said he's never been asked to sign a Who's Who before, one of these.
What?
I find that impossible. Yeah, maybe I misinterpreted what he meant. Maybe he meant he'd never seen one opened like that. I'm not sure.
That's probably.
Probably. Because honestly, my one at home was all falling apart anyway. So I was like, all right, well, this is good. But he was so nice and couldn't be more generous. And we chatted about it and how much he enjoyed that project and some of the trouble he got in for doing that project. And anyway, I meant to mention that earlier. So it was a great experience to talk with Michael Urie. Really, really meant a lot.
And he's a wonderful fellow.
Yeah. So, all right. So back to this one, which he had nothing to do with, but that's okay. Across the top here says, what's new in the DC universe? And then it's got this giant, what I've heard in the industry called a Johnson box. I don't know if it maybe it's called something else, but it's this big red starburst. And it says, update 1993 includes free fold-out poster of Justice League America headquarters. And then, as Rob hinted, the cover is the Dark Stars, which we'll spend more time talking about inside. The only thing I will mention here, though, is the cover. It has a blue starfield background behind them. Inside, they've changed it. It's an orange starfield inside, and I have to say the blue looks better. But anything on the cover before we get into it, Rob?
It's a weird collection of colors. Purple, blue, orange, dark. It's just a kind of a, I don't know. These are not the color choices I would make, but okay.
I'm with you there. So, yep. All right. So the letters page, they did something sort of different this time. Rather than running a bunch of letters, because it's their last one, they focused more on telling you where to find the characters. It's sort of almost a callback to the old Who's Who, where the back page would always have, where to find all those characters. And the editor this time, Bob Cahan, I mean, he just kind of went through and told you where to find all the characters. So I kind of liked that.
Mm-hmm.
So really, then I think with that, we can just jump right into it.
Let's do it.
First entry is Aaron the Immortal, or Arion the Immortal, depending on how you say it. Paul Kupperberg told me how to pronounce it once, and I've already forgotten. I'm sorry.
Arion. He says it as Arion.
Okay. Arion the Immortal. And the art here, it's interesting. It's credited to Ron Wilson. However, if you look at the signatures, it's clearly Ron Wilson and Art Nichols. Art Nichols' name's right on the cover. So, obviously maybe they knew this was going to be the last one. I don't know. So there's two art credits that got missed in this one. So anyway, it is a really cool piece that, Ron Wilson and Art Nichols have done. So it's got Arion in his new modern day uniform, which is all shades of red, almost echoing of Doctor Strange in some regards. And then behind him is, I don't know how to describe this, Rob. Like I've been trying. It's all vertical designs and it's all like almost patchwork kind of together. You're the art guy. How do you describe the background, the way they did this?
It's kind of like a collage. There's just different design elements. There's a checkerboard. There's some sort of like a scratchboard thing. There's like kind of a reflected panes of glass. There's some sort of symbols going there. So it's just kind of a bunch of just different design elements all. But yes, they are all definitely all going vertically down from the top to the bottom. So that's just kind of the general look of the piece.
And maybe it's just I'm an 80s kid, but I freaking love that design, that aesthetic, that look of all the mishmash sort of patterns that shouldn't go together and the colors that shouldn't go together. A lot of Vertigo style or mature readers books used to use this sort of motif. And I think it really works here. So this is Arion in his 1990s design, because he came, and we'll talk in a minute, came from the past to the present. And, so what do you think here, bud? This is probably your first time ever seeing this character in this version, I imagine.
Yeah, I did not know that. Forgive me, Paul Kupperberg, a friend of the network. I didn't know that they kind of redid him. It mentions in the Prince piece that he had a new miniseries. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that. When I first looked at this, I thought, oh, did they do a secondary on? Like, is there like a new guy? But it says first appearance Warlord,
yep,
number 56. And no, that's the original Warlord. Let me see that he's related to Power Girl. So that's the thing. They've kind of rebooted all that stuff to connect all those characters. And so that's what this is. But it's the same guy from the original series, yep, in 1982.
Yeah, so what they've said is he's just been alive all this time. You know, he's Arion, and now he's, rather than being Arion, Lord of Atlantis, he's Arion the Immortal. And so the story here, it's kind of it was a fun miniseries. It didn't really strike a chord as much as I think they were hoping to. But I loved the concepts in it, which was that Arion was still alive, you know, all these thousands and thousands and thousands of years later. And now he's this grumpy, grumpy old man in modern times with no powers. And he hangs out in the park and pulls 3-card Monty rackets to make money. And he hangs out in this New York deli that, you know, the owner of the guy who runs that place is another grumpy old man who's one of his old archenemies from the old days. And it's just kind of funny seeing these old cranky men bicker with each other. And they've just known each other for centuries. So they, even though they were hated each other, now they just kind of figure out how to not get along, but just exist in the same room. So then.
Sounds like the network.
It, you know, after 12 years of doing this, it kind of does, doesn't it? So then suddenly all the magic comes flooding back and he gets all his powers back. And in fact, the glyph that he used to always use in the original series, you know, Jan Dersima would draw, he's using it here again. It's sort of star symbol that looks really, really cool. So anyway, the magic comes flooding back and he gets this new look. It's all in reds. And again, it's got, I feel like it's a little echoey of Doctor Strange, but I still think it's unique enough. I love this look. And, yeah, so you mentioned Paul is there. So it's got created by Paul Kupperberg and Jan Dersima. I think it was a really cool idea on how to bring the character back. I like the idea. Again, I can't really say how successful it was because it obviously didn't resonate in my mind, but he hung around, for a while in the DC universe. He'd make the occasional appearance here and there in a crossover or something. So the miniseries had ended 3 months prior to this. And he would appear, again, occasionally throughout the DC universe. And if you want more on Arion, Lord of Atlantis, you could actually find him on Young Justice. I didn't know that. He made an appearance on Young Justice. That's crazy.
That's great. I hope Paul got a couple of nickels out of that. That's fantastic.
I hope so. All right. Up next. Oh, gosh, folks. Okay. Sorry. I didn't have to do that on the air, but oh, it is the Atomic Skull. And let me say, I love the idea of the Atomic Skull. You and I think I've covered it like 3 times on the network. There's a beloved issue of The Flash where Barry Allen and Firestorm team up to fight the Atomic Skull, and Firestorm gets drunk on radioactivity. George Perez drew it. It's a fantastic story. And I like that version of the Atomic Skull. This post-crisis version, not so much. So I'll describe the art here. So what you've got is the front piece. It's got the new Atomic Skull, who's got a very generic 90s kind of costume where he's wearing tights and there's a vertical white section in the middle and then gray on the outside. And he's got like a leather biker jacket on, and he's got the skull for a head, and he's got a energy or flaming corona around his head. And Rob, does he look at all like anybody you might recognize?
Yeah, that inset of him riding a motorcycle.
Yeah. Yeah. Folks, he looks exactly like a bargain, like if you go to the dollar store and they have the toys hanging up that are like knockoffs of other people's. He's like the dollar store version of Ghost Rider.
Just think, Shag, in this inset picture, Nicolas Cage has played both these characters.
Wait, what?
Nicolas Cage played Ghost Rider.
Oh, and Superman.
And
oh,
he played, right, Superman. Oh my god. It's official now.
Oh my
god. It's in a movie. So,
oh god. That's messed up. Okay. So back to the front. He's got his arms raised like he's like, you know, pulling a Monster Mash dance or something. The name Atomic Skull is just in a font and it's purple on top of gray.
So hard to read.
It's a hard to read. The only interesting thing about the piece is the background is a film strip right? So you've got different frames showing, and it is the original Atomic Skull, the pre-crisis Atomic Skull. So what they're saying in this iteration was that the version you and I knew from the 70s was a movie character. And that inspired this guy, once he got powers, to claim the title of the Atomic Skull. He's basing it on an old movie serial character is what he's doing.
I mean, that's not the worst thing I've heard. It's just, I don't know. I like the old goofy yellow and green hip boots look with the skull. You know, this new one, I'm just kind of like, oh, well, he's got sneakers. Like, oh, really? Okay. But, you know.
I'm not even demanding like the previous look, but just to do the skull head with the flaming energy corona riding a motorcycle and the leather jacket. Seriously? And they're doing this, by the way, 1 year after Marvel had just revitalized the character. Like they brought they introduced the Danny Ketch Ghost Rider 1 year prior to the Atomic Skull's first appearance. So it's like, really? Oh, this is just not good. Not good.
A skull with a mask on is just weird and cool, and so I miss the mask. I wish they had a mask, because it's just a strange detail.
So this just, as much as I love the Superman books at the time, this just fell completely flat for me. They tried to make a big deal out of the movie reel part of it, which was kind of interesting. If I remember right, I think you had to turn, I could be wrong, Michael Bailey, help me out. I think you had to turn the comic long ways to like see it like a movie, like widescreen kind of thing, if I remember right. Or there was something about film strip. It was some interesting stuff, but again, so much like Ghost Rider. It just doesn't sit well. Anyway, the art, I should mention, the art's by John Bogdanov and Dennis Janke.
Great artwork.
The artwork is fine. It's just the print, the concept of it is just the real fail here.
Yeah.
Now, strangely enough, if you want more about the Atomic Skull, you could, of course, go to our buddy Michael Bailey's show, From Crisis to Crisis. You could also listen to the JLU Cast podcast. Or you could watch Young Justice. You could watch DC animated DVDs. You could play the Scribblenauts video game. I had no idea this character had gotten so prolific and appeared in so many places. Anyway, so he had appeared 2 years prior to this. His first appearance is Adventures of Superman 483 as the character of Joe Martin and as the Atomic Skull. It was at Action Comics 670, which was the same month. And the border is black for villain. And the writer of this entry is Roger Stern. You know, I forgot to say, because I've gotten so out of practice, on the Arion the Immortal, Paul Kupperberg wrote that entry, so I should point that out, and had the red border for Hero, of course. Mm-hmm. Could have been purple for Supernatural. I know how you feel about that.
Yeah. This will be the last, I guess, the last time episode I get to make this complaint. If a character is based on another concept, they should always list the historical version as the first appearance. Because this version for Spirit and Adventure 43, but he's based on the other one. And so I think just for the sake of completeness, they should put historical, you know, whatever the book is. And then this version is this, just because this is not an original idea. It's based on something else.
Yep. Totally, totally agree. Yeah. So that doesn't happen very often between us. But no. All right. So the next up entry is Battalion. Oh, the 90s are coming in hard here. They're coming in hot, Rob. By Kevin Maguire and Will Blyberg. Now, if you've got to have a completely over-the-top 90s character, sure, give me Kevin Maguire and Will Blyberg. That's fine, because at least, well, all the 90s aesthetics are there. I still like the art, kind of.
Oh, the artwork's great. Yeah. Sure.
It's great. It's just, it's so 90s. You know, okay, first of all, Battalion is... he's from Team Titan, so we'll talk a lot more about them later. But Team Titan, he's a big muscle-bound character. Okay, first of all, by the way, he's their version of Cable. I'm just going to put that out there to save you some trouble. You know, if Team Titans is DC's version of X-Force, he is their version of Cable. Start with the grizzled big gun idea right there. So you've got, he's scowling. He's got hair that's got more hair gel than you could possibly buy in the grocery store. He's got shoulders pads with spikes. He's got arm sleeves with spikes. He's got a giant gun. He's got knee pads. He's got giant boots. His feet are obscured because it's 90s. I mean, it's so 90s. It's awesome, but it's Kevin Maguire, so it's kind of fun.
I'd be scowling too if I had that tight a strap on my junk the way he's got going on. Can I tell you, when I got to this listing, I've never heard of this character.
Right.
I had no idea who this was. I honestly thought to myself, oh my God, the Brother Bear from the Forever People went dark. That's what this was.
It looks like him, doesn't it?
That's what I thought. Wow, they went extreme with the Forever People. Okay, that's a take. And then I was like, oh, it's somebody else entirely.
Well, they tried everything else with the Forever People, so why not?
Yeah, exactly. Why not? Sure.
So Battalion was a really new character at this point. He'd only been around for 3 months. And so his appearance here is very, very timely. By the way, again, the logo is just a font. And again, it's hard to read. They put purple on top of a pink explosion. So it's not easy to read. Yeah. But Kevin Maguire, he was not drawing the Teen Titans book, but he did help with the launch of the Teen Titans series. That's why he got this gig here doing this one. Because he did some covers. He may have done a backup story. Tom Panarese would have to call me out on that one. But so he definitely helped with the launch of Teen Titans, but he wasn't their regular artist by any means. So that makes sense why he would draw this. And so if you look on the back, you know, it's very short on information.
He sure is.
You get like half a column. It's really it's three columns long. So there's a lot of white space here. So this is one of the weaknesses of this format is that, you know, when they don't have a lot of information, it'd be nice to fill it out with art instead. But yeah, so there's not much there. They didn't even bother to fill out height and weight. They just left it blank. He's affectionately called the Drill Sergeant from Hell. And again, we're going to talk more about the Teen Titans later, but the gist of it is he's from the future and he was tortured by this bad guy named Lord Chaos. He was tortured for 2 years, which is horrible. He eventually escapes and he ends up training the Teen Titans. Again, he's the drill instructor. That's kind of their thing. Sadly, Teen Titans was an experiment that kind of didn't work. And so this didn't really get anywhere. So Teen Titans was on issue number 5 on the shelf at this point. Again, he'd only been around for 3 months himself, which is part of the reason you really don't know anything about him. I do sort of like the inset pictures. You know, he's shooting a gun. Is he punching a semi? Is that what he's doing?
I can't quite tell what is going on there. I do love that one inset of him firing the guns. That's a beautiful, fun drawing.
Well, Kevin Maguire is so great at facial expressions. Yeah, it's great. Yeah. So anyway, the writer on this is Marv Wolfman. So Marv Wolfman was writing the Teen Titans at first. The border is red for Hero. First appearance is Teen Titans number 2. If you want more on Battalion, you know, I'm sure at some point Tighten Up the Defense is covering that. Or our buddy Tom Panarese with his pop culture affidavit blog. Honestly, I don't know if he ever got as far as Teen Titans. I would be surprised if he hadn't. So fun stuff. All right, moving on to the next one. Bloodwind. Oh, Bloodwind. Oh, I'm so looking forward to talking about this.
Boy, Frank's comments are just going to be unbelievable.
Okay, so I think you just answered a question for me, which is going to be, do you even know who this is?
I do.
Okay, yes. And you know the gimmick with him?
This was right around the point I gave up on that Justice League series. I was like, I think I'm done. I think I'm good.
Right. Now, let's talk artistically, because artistically, I really, really like this. So it's Dan Jurgens and Rick Burchett, and Dan designed a character doing something that's very unusual. He gave the character an all-white costume, which you just don't see very often because it doesn't reproduce that well in comics. But at this point in the 90s, comics had gotten better with reproduction. So it looks really snazzy. He's got an all-white costume, you know, white, you know, unitard kind of thing. He's an African-American gentleman, so he has his face exposed except for, like, his eyes are covered. His hair is out there. But he's got black gloves and some kind of cool jewelry. He's got this huge kind of 1990s cape. Right. So a crazy, crazy sort of cape. Looks like Spawn borrowed or something. Again, just a font. Also still hard to read. This is Bloodwind, but he's got the moon behind him, but it's a very dynamic pose. He's flying, or maybe he's doing some river dance. I'm not sure which, but, so what do you think of the drawing?
It's a nice drawing. I actually don't know if you even need all the little ornaments there. Mm-hmm. I think it's kind of gummies it up a little, but the design is great. Just the simple, right? You don't see a lot of white uniforms. So it's a nice piece. I like the logo, that it's almost a logo because it's a little more than just a font. But again, with the purple, what's the purple this month?
That's a font, Rob. Don't mean to break your heart. That's a shadow.
Well, font. Okay. No, I know it's okay. I know it's a font. I just mean it has a little more character to it.
Okay. That's fair. Yeah.
That it looks like a logo as opposed to just they got a font. But yes, it is clearly just a font.
Yeah. So, all right. So on the back, so we get into Bloodwind. Now keep in mind, this is at the same time, by the way, Justice League America number 71 is on the shelf. Superman has just died. Okay. So at this point, we don't know who Bloodwind is. We don't know the secret. So if you don't know who Bloodwind is, brace yourself, because, you know, first of all, it's this new character. He's magically based. He joins the Justice League, kind of comes out of the blue, helps him. They invite him to join the team, but there's a mystery here. And like Blue Beetle's trying to solve it. And everyone's wondering what the deal is with him. It's nice to add a new character with African-American representation on the Justice League, because goodness knows it needs some diversity on the team. And unfortunately, Jurgens had a story he wanted to tell about Bloodwind, but it got truncated. He told you and I this on an interview we did with him one time. It got truncated because Death of Superman just took over his entire life. And so he couldn't give as much time to Justice League as he wanted. So he had to leave the book, and they had to truncate the Bloodwind story and not let it play out like he originally intended. So what the big secret is dun, 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 Bloodwind is actually Martian Manhunter. And now, as they established, it's Martian Manhunter plus a separate entity who's Bloodwind. And so eventually it becomes two individual characters, a Bloodwind and a Martian Manhunter. But really, once Dan's off the book, Bloodwind doesn't really hang around with the Justice League all that much longer. He kind of disappears, fades away, whatever happens to him there. First appearance is Justice League of America number 61, so he'd only been around for 10 months there. The writer on this entry is Mark Waid, and the border is red for Hero. Again, could have been Supernatural, whatever, whatever. Anything you want to add on the character before we move on?
No.
Okay. He is blasting the Weapons Master on the back, which is kind of cool with his vision powers. And you see Blue Beetle kind of stalking him there. Again, nice look by Dan. I always like Dan's version of Blue Beetle, so it looks great. And if you want more, as you said, I imagine you could go to Idle Head of Diablo. You probably find out more about Bloodwind. And if not, then Frank's falling down on the job. All right, next is television star Candlemaker. So this is a Doom Patrol villain. This is a major foe of the Grant Morrison's Doom Patrol era. The art is by Stan, and I don't know, is it Stan Walk? I would assume.
I've always assumed it was Walk. I've never heard it pronounced, but.
So Stan Walk, and it is sort of just a creepy gray beastie looking humanoid character with a horrible kind of zombie cadaver kind of face, but wearing a crown of candles. You know, literally a crown of, what is that, maybe a dozen lit candles around his head. And he actually has a logo that says Candlemaker, and it looks pretty cool, actually.
It looks like a band logo from the 70s. Like, you know, like I think Candlemaker opened for Molly Hatchet, I think. I'm not sure.
I was thinking it was Boston and Candlemaker, but yeah, absolutely. So anything on the art? Let's just start with that.
It's a nice piece. I do notice that he is called Candlemaker, and on the back, he is the Candlemaker.
Oh, okay. That's fair. Yeah.
I get he's on the Doom Patrol TV show, I assume, by your saying.
Yes, he made it to the Doom Patrol TV show. Absolutely.
Unbelievable.
So. I know.
I really think the Doom Patrol TV show was a money laundering operation. I don't believe for one moment that show made a dime. I'm not knocking its quality, but it was so obscure. I just think that was David Zaslav's way of laundering some money. So
could be. Well, I love the design of wearing a crown of candles. I mean, it's really cool the way that looks. It's a neat idea. I had never seen anything like that, and it kind of stands out. So the whole idea behind the Candlemaker, it's steeped in very Morrison-esque stuff, guys. So I can't really explain it all that well, but it's very tied to Dorothy Spinner, who was a young member of the Doom Patrol. And it was this terrible spirit, basically from another dimension, which was constantly trying to push her to make horrible wishes, which Candlemaker would come true. Like she wished someone would die and then they died, that kind of thing. And by committing to this with Dorothy, she was giving him power in the real world, is basically what happened. And if I remember right, and this is coming from a Waiting for Doom podcast promo, I want to say they say Dorothy Spinner blew out his candles at one point. Maybe, I don't know. Right now, to give you some perspective, he first appeared in Doom Patrol 44. Right now on the shelves, the same time as this issue, Doom Patrol number 63 is on the shelf, which is notable because that was Grant Morrison's last issue, actually. And 1 month before Vertigo launched. So we are literally 1 month before Vertigo launches where we are here right now with this update, Rob.
Wow.
Huh. Yeah.
Okay.
So the powers, I love that Mark Waid wrote this. He wrote, you name it.
You name it.
Candlemaker can do whatever he wants. Again, Mark Waid wrote it. Border is black for villain. First appearance, as I already mentioned. And again, if you want more, Waiting for Doom podcast or Doom Patrol TV show, which is crazy. TV star. Nuts. Then we jump from TV star to movie star. I kid you not. Kongorilla. So, yes, Kongorilla by Neil Vokes and Jay Geldof. Geldhoff, I guess you should say. They did the front piece of Kongorilla here. And it's your giant orange, or what do they call him? Golden ape, I think is what they call him. And he's got on a fun, like, Sergeant Pepper kind of jacket, looks like, you know, with I Love New York buttons. And he looks a little savage, but he sort of looks like, you know, he's a little dressed up for the day. And he has a logo, actually. It says Congorilla. That's looks like it's almost bloody and dripping.
Yeah.
Is that all you got on this?
I'm just letting you go, man. Just do it. Talk Congorilla.
You're the art guy. Come on.
I didn't get blood for it, but I got more like a, because it's not red, but it is dripping. I got more like a, you know, like it's paint, but I mean.
Oh, okay. Yeah, sure.
It makes more sense that it would be blood because, you know, paint doesn't make any sense kind of in the jungle, but I see what you're saying.
Yeah. So at the point, the reason he's in here is because there is a Congorilla miniseries going on at this time. That's why he's in this update. Congorilla is on issue number 4 at this point. It's sort of an interesting history with the character because Congorilla has been multiple characters. It started as Congo Bill,
right,
back in 1940. All right. Then Congo Bill was around for 15 years as like a strip. Then in 1957, Congo Bill met a gorilla named Congorilla. And I guess they met a couple times. And then in 1959, that's when they started the whole thing where Congo Bill would transform into Congorilla. And that only was published for like 2 years, but everyone remembers that version of Congorilla. It's interesting. Congo Bill's around 15 years. Nope. The version everyone remembers is the one that was around for 2 years where he would transfer into the body of Congorilla. So the reason I mentioned movie star is because there was a 1948 movie serial all about Congo Bill.
So, isn't that amazing? I've never seen it. I'd love to see it, but it's amazing that he was that popular.
I'd be shocked if a movie serial about someone out in the jungle from 1948 isn't necessarily acceptable material nowadays. Let's just
probably put it that way. It's probably not super culturally sensitive. But
thank you. That's the better way to put it. Yeah.
It is unbelievable that a backup strip in the Action Comics could somehow generate enough heat that they were like, let's make a movie serial out of it. Like,
that's just absolutely amazing. Nuts. I didn't know who Neil Vokes was before I rattled this off.
Friends with Neil.
No kidding. Seriously? Yes.
Yeah, he's from this area, and he used to do appearances at a comic shop that is no longer with us, but every year I would get Aquaman pinups from him. I have an Aquaman from him. I have a Mira, a Black Manta, a Trench drawing.
Oh, really?
Great guy. Yes, okay. great guy.
Wow, okay. And
superb artist.
Yeah, he really is. I love the inset pictures, especially where the Congo Bill is looking at the medallion, and then there's later where they're transferring minds. It looks great. So I didn't know. Yeah, I had to look him up. You know, big artist in the 80s, worked for Comico and Marvel and DC and Dark Horse, and had quite a career. So it's really cool. If you want more of Congorilla, you could check out the 1999 Congorilla Vertigo miniseries, which is crazy. That must have been a real trip. And also, believe it or not, the character of Congo Bill, his real name was William Glenn Morgan, and William Glenn Morgan appeared on the Arrow TV show because, of course, he did.
Of course, he did.
All right, up next is Rob. Oh, by the way, Banner is red, and the writer is Mark Waid. So, and up next is Rob's favorite title out of 1993, The Dark Stars. So, you know, the promo for this show had you going like Dark Stars, like, you know, like you didn't even know who they were in the promo. And so here we go. So art is by Travis Cherist and Terry Austin. Once again, Travis Cherist has signed a Who's Who entry so large that Terry Austin had to like jam his signature off to the side to fit. So let's talk about this. So you've got the main character, which is Farron Kalos. He's the bald guy in the front, the alien. He is the Dark Star. He's the alien appointed as Dark Star. The people surrounding him are his human deputies. So these are people that he's recruited on Earth to be like his deputies, and he's given them sort of a scaled down version of his super powerful armor. The colors are rough. Like, I like the colors. Not that I love the colors on the cover. I like the colors on the cover better than the colors here. Here it's yellows and oranges, whereas the cover was blues. How do you feel about the colors right now?
I actually like this one more. I feel okay. Like it's fire, explosions kind of thing. I think it's a little more exciting.
Okay. Now, Travis Cherist is kind of a Jim Lee clone at this point. So you've got a very static kind of, you know, Jim Lee's famous for drawing great pinups, right? But not dynamic action. And that's kind of what you got here. You got a pinup of the characters. You know, you've got a guy with a mustache. You've got a guy who doesn't have a mustache, but looks exactly like the guy with the mustache without a mustache. Then you've got the sexy girl. And then you've got the bald alien and who has the exact same face as the other guys. You know, it's kind of cookie cutter repeat. And I don't mean to be mean. It's just he was kind of new in his career. And this is how he was drawing in the Jim Lee style.
Everybody's over-designed.
Yeah.
Too much stuff. Too much stuff on their chests, their shoulders. Just, it's, everything's over-accessorized. But that's what it was.
So I've been aware of the Dark Stars now for 30 years. And until this moment, I never realized they have what looks like a keyboard on their chest.
Yeah, I noticed that.
I am never going to be able to unsee that now. Now, Travis Sheriff did have quite a career and went on to work, as Frank's already writing in the comments. He had quite a career, went on to work for Wildstorm. He kind of developed his own look for a while there, different from Jim Lee. So, yeah, he's an accomplished artist. This is very early in his career. So sort of the sad thing about this, though, that I've always found is when you flip to the back, you'll see the Dark Stars were created by Michael Jan Friedman, famous sci-fi writer, and Larry Stroman. And Larry Stroman's a great artist, by the way. And Larry Stroman drew the interiors for most of the early Dark Star issues. But Travis Cherris always got the cover. Travis Cherris got the Who's Who entry. It's because Travis Cherris was the new hot thing. You know, he was going to be DC's Jim Lee and all that. And he didn't stay around long with DC. And so Larry Stroman, who helped create the character, you know, kind of got to be the other guy, which I always felt was pretty unfair.
Yeah. I mean, he's doing all the heavy lifting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the idea here is that, you know, sort of like the Green Lanterns were created by the Guardians, right? Another splinter faction from OO, the Controllers, you probably remember them from Justice League, the Controllers formed their own space cops called the Dark Stars. So in space at this point in 1993, you've got the Green Lantern Corps, you've got the acronym Legion, and you have the Dark Stars, all three of them operating as space cops, essentially. And in this case, Farron Collis was this like kind of grizzled older cop, this alien. He gets assigned to Earth. And now the article talks about how he's recruited two human deputies, the two guys. But clearly, Travis Cherris has plans for this African-American, or maybe it's a Latino woman, to be on the team with them. I don't know. I can't remember the book. I read several issues. I don't remember a thing about it. So I guess she was part of the team as well. She's featured pretty heavily here in the art.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. Great. I love doing podcasting by myself.
What do you expect me to say about
this? I don't know. We could have a conversation about space cops. How many space cops does DC really need? You know, I don't know. Whatever.
Exactly. I'm just waiting for you to move on. Like, why do we need to talk about Dark Stars?
Well, okay. Just so you know, Dark Stars is very, very new at this point. They're only on issue 4, which is probably why this young woman was not part of the team yet. It's because she hadn't been added to the team. It was going to be soon. You know, and they planned for her, but she just, by the time this was written, they didn't mention her because she hadn't been out of the team yet. So Dark Stars is only on issue number 4. It ends up going 38 issues, and they really did try to do some different stuff. They had a big crossover with Green Lanterns and Legion to have, like, you know, a big space cop discussion or whatever. And as time went by, other people joined the team. For example, John Stewart, when the Green Lantern Corps fell apart, eventually became a Dark Star. Donna Troy became a Dark Star, which actually worked pretty well because when her and Kyle Rayner were kind of a romantic duo, that kind of worked well because he had the Green Lantern ring. She was a Dark Star. They were, you know, dating, worked well. So anyway, the border is red for hero, but it says hero organization, which is kind of cool. And if you want more on Dark Stars, no one but me remembers them. So, is written by Robert Greenberger. And that is all we're going to say about that. Up next, have you heard of this character, Rob?
Yeah, he's a movie star.
He is a movie star.
He was in that movie that almost broke the network.
Do we need to bring that up tonight? We are talking about Doomsday. Yes. So Doomsday is here. It is an awesome drawing by Tom Grummet and Brett Breeding.
Yes.
And it is Doomsday. He's still dressed in the green garbs that he wore when he first appeared, but they're shredded. He's breaking out of the garbs. He's breaking through a brick wall, and he's coming at you, and he looks great. He's got, you know, the big bone knuckles ripping through the gloves, and he's coming at you. So I know you're not the biggest fan of Doomsday, but what about this drawing?
It's a superb drawing. I've said many, many times across Who's Who, Tom Grummet, one of the great underrated superhero comic book artists. I think his stuff's always just incredibly solid and dynamic. I don't think he kind of got enough praise for all that. And Brett Breeding is a superb anchor. So it's a great draw.
Yeah, it really is. And Doomsday isn't one of my favorite characters either, but damn, this looks great. I mean, this is, especially with that green outfit on, the containment suit that he had to wear. It looks great with him coming out of it. It's so good. And this is a really interesting capturing a moment in time. Okay. Because if you flip to the back, I mean, talk about no text. I mean, there's not even half a column here of text. He's got a little tiny paragraph, and it's written very purposefully to be vague as hell.
Yes, it is.
And that's because, Rob, when this comic hit the shelves, Doomsday had killed Superman just 3 weeks before. 3 weeks is how, now he'd been around a little bit longer than that because there was a little bit of a buildup to it, but just 3 weeks before this, he had killed Superman. So with the way they wrote this, they didn't even say he killed Superman.
Nope.
He said they had a battle. It's all written in the past tense as if Doomsday's not alive anymore, because at that point, we all thought he was dead.
He was finally stopped by Superman, yeah.
Yep. Well, go ahead and finish reading it.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Going to read it. He was finally stopped by Superman only after an epic battle, which raged cross-country and ended in one of the greatest tragedies of the 20th century. Like, the first time I read it, it kind of gave me chills, because the death of Superman still gets to me. And, wow, yeah, you know, what a way to say the death of Superman without saying the death of Superman. And so, yeah, again, the lack of text is sort of amazing, sort of telling, right?
The inset is just one panel.
Yeah.
Of him and Superman fighting. Cause it's sort of like, look, this is what Doomsday's known for.
Going
to be known for is this. That's it. We don't need to show you three different pieces of his history. It's just, this is the thing, the battle.
Yep. And again, only 3 weeks since Superman 75. So this is very, very recent. They say his first appearance was Superman Man of Steel number 17, November 1992, which would have literally just been 7 weeks before that. So, I mean, 10 weeks ago when this hit the shelves. Great timing on their part, by the way, to get this in there. But if you want more on Doomsday, you said it. He's a movie star, folks. You can see him in Batman versus Superman. You can watch him on TV on Smallville or Krypton or Justice League Unlimited or tons of animated movies or tons of video games. Or again, you go to Michael Bailey's Crisis to Crisis podcast. I mean, it's just unbelievable how big this character has become in pop culture. You know, like little kids know him, which is so weird. Do you think he's not more now. I was going to say, is he more of a household name than Lex Luthor? But No, that's not the case. Not the case. Okay. I talked myself out of that. All right. Black border for villain. Text is by Roger Stern. So there we go. All right. Next entry is Guy Gardner by Joe Staton and Terry Beatty. Now, it's got Guy in five different guises. In the front is Guy's current costume, which is where he is wearing the Sinestro ring. He's got a yellow power ring, so he's wearing jeans with big old cowboy boots with his G logo on the sides of them. He's got a black leather jacket with a big G symbol on it and a giant belt buckle. I mean, he looks ridiculous, but it's really not that much of a step further than his Green Lantern costume. You know, even though the Green Lantern costume, we all loved it. But if you really look at it, the Green Lantern costume he wore looked ridiculous. And this is kind of that next evolution of that. So behind him, you kind of have sort of faded images. Maybe they're done in pencil and not ink. I'm not really sure how they did that. But you've got Guy Gardner in his like Justice League costume. You've got Guy Gardner, a Green Lantern costume. You've got him as, you know, in that sort of Hal costume. Then you've got him as a basketball coach, and then you've got him as a social worker. And they're all getting smaller and fainter as they go to the past. So, and then you've got the logo of Guy Gardner where the G's are huge in the sort of like a diamond sort of motif. So, Joe Staton and Terry Beatty, what do you think of this?
Great artwork. Love Joe Staton. Always have. Guy Gardner is just, I know, you know, he's beloved to you and he's a big fixture of JLI, of course. I kind of got my fill of him in the first year of JLI. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, all right, I kind of have enough with this guy. You know what I mean? Okay. So I've never loved him the way a lot of people have. Your question, I don't know, you weren't really asking a question, but if you're curious, what I'm assuming, this is probably still pre computer graphics. Mm-hmm. This is probably all done by hand. I'm guessing the way they did the fade there is you put a piece of, like, you do the pose, the front pose on a separate piece of artwork, and then the background is another piece, and you put an overlay over it of a slight transparency, so it makes all the background images faded. Main figure pops. I love on the back that the entry is written from his point of view. That's fun. Yeah. Very Guy Gardner. It even says text Guy Gardner with Mark Waid.
Yeah.
which is fun. So yeah, I have no inkling about this iteration of him with this outfit or whatever. I didn't know about any of this. I didn't know that was a Sinestro ring, any of that stuff.
It didn't actually last that long. It probably only lasted maybe not even 2 years. So what happens is, him and Hal have it out finally. Like they Hal, or I don't know who challenged him to the fight. Either they end up in a fight and they say, all right, look, one of us, whoever wins, gets to be the Green Lantern of the Earth. The other one quits the Corps. And so they fought and Guy lost. And so Guy had to quit the Corps. And so then he decides, well, I'm not done being a hero. So he gets Lobo's help and they go out and get Sinestro's ring. And he uses the Sinestro's ring now to sort of do Green Lantern type stuff, but with yellow. Didn't last all that long. I'll say it. Joe Staton, I absolutely love his work from the 1970s. Not as big of a fan of his style in the 80s, you know, Millennium and this era of Guy Gardner. But I will still say the man can still draw. I just met him at HeroesCon, and he did a beautiful Power Girl sketch for me, which is stunning. And I've seen several other, you know, Huntress sketches he did while he's there. The man is unbelievably such a talented artist, even 30 years after this. It's just this era in the late 80s, early 90s was not my – I didn't care for what he was doing at that point.
It got cartoonier.
Yeah. And it was a certain style that then he'd used to segue into Dick Tracy, which really worked for him. So it didn't work for me here. So I do have a question about one of the inset pictures. So in the bottom right picture, he's there with the Justice League because he was still a member of the team with the yellow ring. And he's created a yellow hand, and Ice looks shocked. Did he maybe slap her on the bottom or something? Like, I'm trying to figure out what's going on there.
I don't know. It doesn't, okay. That doesn't look like it, if that's what they're trying to suggest. But yeah, she does look kind of like sort of thing.
She's looking back.
I love that Superman here. That is the beefiest Superman I've ever seen.
It does look good, doesn't it? Yeah. So you mentioned it. The text is fun. Guy Gardner's snarky attitude. I love that. Now, as far as Guy Gardner, so what happens is, again, he loses the Green Lantern ring. He gets the yellow ring for a while. Again, maybe 2 years. Then Emerald Twilight happens, where Hal goes crazy. And every Green Lantern loses their powers, which includes Guy with the yellow ring. So the only ring left is Kyle Rayner's. So Guy ends up going on a quest for powers, and that's where you get the Beau Smith run with Mitch Bird, where Guy becomes an alien, a Vundurian, and all this stuff, and has all these alien powers and all the body makeup, which... on the surface, and most people roll their eyes at that era because they don't like the alien stuff. They don't like the body paint, all that. That was not Beau Smith's fault. DC pigeonholed him on what he could and couldn't do. And so he had to work with what he could. But if you actually read the comics, they're great. They took the Guy Gardner that you couldn't stand, and they didn't just push that under the rug. They said, here's the jerk. And then they showed him grow and become a much more interesting, much more complex, still a jerk, but you know what? The kind of jerk that you might want to actually spend some time with. And that's where they introduce the Warriors Bar. So it started with this Green Lantern series that they're talking about here, but then it continues on and becomes a much more interesting character. And I love that Beau Smith run. I really, really do. So first appearance is Green Lantern number 59 back in March 1968. That's amazing how far back he goes. We've already talked about the writer, and the border is red for hero because, yeah, Guy Gardner's a hero. And if you want more on Guy Gardner, there is a podcast you could listen to if you wanted, all about Justice League International. I don't know. Might be worth listening to. Your choice, folks. All right. Up next is, oh my gosh. All right. Talk about a timeliness and wasted page. Jacob Warsman is this guy's name. Now, the art is very pretty. It's by Trevor Von Eden, and it's got this huge image of him in the background. It's just a dude with red hair. Okay, and he's wearing like a turtleneck and a suit jacket, and he's smoking a cigarette. And then in the foreground, you've got Black Canary fighting a ninja, and there's blood and ninja stars and all. And she's clearly taken out like three guys already. So the image, what do you think of the image?
The portrait is kind of but
really?
Okay, yeah, that was all right. And the font is just a font, yeah. And the name, you know, Jacob Horseman, like, okay. But the little poses, that's again Trevor Von Eden inking himself. I love the sort of Frank Miller-esque ninjas fighting Black Canary. That stuff looks great. I wish that was bigger in the picture.
That's fair. Okay, yeah, I can see that. So he was something of a big thing for four issues of Black Canary, as near as I can tell. Now, maybe I'm wrong, but that's the near as I can tell. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail. I mean, it's a guy. He's a businessman. He had a really, really rough childhood. I mean, really bad. Then he met motivational speaker Tony Robbins. I'm not kidding. Now, they call him Tony Roberts here to avoid being sued, but he met Tony Robbins. Like, no crap. I'm not kidding. Tony helped him find his path to success. But the thing is, he becomes a businessman with no conscience. So he'll do anything for a profit. Absolutely illegal criminal activities, human trafficking, everything you can think of. Horrible stuff. Again, lasted four issues. And he's already on, at this point, on the shelves as Black Canary number two. So he's only around like two more months. So, I mean... it's timely, but he didn't become a thing. The entry is written by Sarah Byam, B-Y-A-M. I'm going to guess that's the writer on the Black Canary series. Ryan Daly could tell us. I don't really know. Border is black for villain. First appearance is Green Arrow annual number 5, which helped launch some of the Black Canary stuff. And if you want more, you could probably listen to that Power of Fishnets podcast that used to be around. All right. Up next is...
Here we go.
Yeah, here we go. The Justice Society of America by Mike Parabek and Terry Austin. And holy crap, this thing should be a poster on my wall. It is an amazing, as you would expect, Mike Parabek drawing. Lots of dynamic stuff going on. You've got, you know, the teams. So you've got Alan Scott shooting a blast of green energy, kind of leaning back like he's really, you know, kind of bracing himself. You've got Jay Garrick running at the screen. You've got Carter Hall flying as Hawkman. You've got the Johnny Thunderbolt flying through the air. You've got Hawkwoman. You've got Dr. Midnight with a giant smile on his face. You've got Johnny Quick, Wildcat, and Adam. And it doesn't feel crowded. Nope. All those people, and it doesn't feel crowded.
Yep. Man knows how to stage things.
So good. So talk about Mike Parabek, because, I mean, I think we're both leaning into how much we love this entry, right? Like, talk about, as an artist here, how difficult is it to use so few lines and capture so much?
Well, I mean, Alex Toth famously said, you know, you have to, you sort of get rid of all the non-essential stuff, and then what you've got left is what the drawing should be. And you know, it, and I will say, back when, what the hell? Let's get one more mention in before we wrap up the show. Back when I was at the Joe Kubert School, why not? You know, a lot of us tried to take that approach, except you have to have the skill to pull it off. You can't do the shortcut of just not drawing a lot. You have to have all the basic anatomy and all the dynamism there. And then you can pull all the details that you don't need to get down to the basic stuff. Mike Parabek had the skills, obviously. Part of the reason I do, I mean, the work is superb. Part of the reason, obviously, he is so beloved is because he died very young. And so, you know, we were all denied years of probably great work. And that's part of the, you know, you see this and you can't help but think that of like, oh man, what a loss of just what a great talent. And, you know, it's hard to do this cartoony stuff because sometimes you can go too far and the characters don't have any weight or form or any real heft to them. But he always managed to give them these figures, again, some real solidity. And these poses, this is just a wonderfully constructed piece. Everyone's pose is a little different. I mean, God, he's even got extra room kind of on the upper left quadrant.
Yeah, he does. Yeah.
It's amazing. A lot of artists, if you said draw, what do we got? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 figures. Draw 9 figures in one page. It would look like an absolute mob scene and you wouldn't be able to see what you're looking at because they don't know how to structure things. But he does. He does. And, the colors are absolutely fantastic. Glenn Whitmore. The logo was great. The Justice Society of America, the sort of old timey logo. Everyone is properly represented and it just looks dynamic as hell. And I love that he planted the camera down in the ground. So we're kind of pointing up at everybody. It's just great. And then the inset pictures of their headshots, it's just, you're just like, yeah, this is what I love about the DC Comics is this sort of thing.
Yeah, it really is. I have two monitors, on my personal computer and also work computer. And one of my, so each one has different wallpaper. One's JLI. The other one is the promotional poster for this series for JLI. I'm sorry, Justice Society. So it's a Mike Parabek, promo poster he did for Justice Society. It's similar to this, different poses, but it's very, very similar. And I look at it every day and it just brings me pure joy. So I've said this on social media, but I want to make sure to get the word as far as I can. So folks, coming in summer 2024, once the JLI podcast wraps next summer, in the summer of 2024, I will begin monthly coverage of this JSA series, this 10-issue JSA series. I'm going to cover one issue a month on the JSA Presents podcast. So I'm going to be going issue by issue, starting again next summer, covering that JLI Justice Society series. And then after that, I'm going to cover the miniseries that came before that. And I'm going to spend some time with the JSA in the 90s. So I'm really looking forward to doing that. So what's going on here is the JSA are back. That's what's happened at the DC Universe at this point. You know, they were gone after Crisis, and then they got brought back in a terrible Armageddon 2001 miniseries that no one wants to remember, and that's fine. But they came back, and so they decided to give them a series to say, okay, here are some older superheroes. What is it like being a geriatric superhero in this world full of young heroes? And what does that mean for them? And that's what the series was about. I've been rereading it lately, and it's really about them trying to find a purpose among these young heroes. So they start looking at mentoring younger heroes. They start looking at what can we teach these young heroes? The legacy aspect is there because very quickly, Jesse Quick joins, you know, starts hanging out with them, who's Johnny Quick's daughter. You know, it really be, and then there's a new person in charge of the Thunderbolt for a while. So it really becomes about legacy, which is, that's everything DC's about, right? In the post-crisis era is the legacy stuff. So with Mike Paraback and Len Straczynski writing it, this thing was a complete win. The back goes into the history of the whole JSA, you know, over starting from the 1940s. And then it talks about the modern setting. And it's sort of interesting. They pay very special attention to the Flash, Green Lantern, Hawkman, and the Atom, but then they just kind of say, and others. And they very quickly rattle off like Hourman and Starman and Dr. Midnight, and Wildcat and Johnny Thunder and things like that. They rattle them off very quickly. So it's sort of interesting that who they perceive is going to be the main characters of this series probably. Right now, the series is Justice Society of America's on issue number 6. And I guess this was it? Yeah, this was the first ongoing series for the Justice Society ever, wasn't it?
I guess, right? Yeah, they were always in Adventure or All-Star.
Yeah.
They never really had their own. Yeah.
And they had the miniseries, which was 8 issues right before this, but that was very specifically a miniseries. So yeah, this was the first ongoing. Sadly, it only lasted 10 issues. It was canceled. Honestly, the way the story goes, it was canceled before number one even hit the shelves. There was an editor at DC, and this is the way the story goes, that did not like the idea of having geriatric heroes, thought it sent the wrong message in the extreme 90s, and so he basically let the book run and killed it, which is unfortunate because, I mean, there is a massive popularity for the series. Again, it's Mike Paraback. Like you said, not only did we lose him, but, you know, we got robbed in this series. He could have done the series for 6 years, you know, or something, you know? And just such a heartbreak. Anyway, they're on issue 6 at this point. The writer is Mark Waid of this entry. Of course it is. The border is, it says the original hero team. I love that. That's fantastic. First appearance, of course, is All-Star Comics number 3, Winter 1940. And if you want more of the JSA, of course, you can listen to the JSA Presents podcast, as we mentioned. There's also A World on Fire, which follows the All-Star Squadron, lots of other JSA appearances. You can listen to the Earth 2 podcast. All these are friends of ours, friends, so definitely check those out. Or if you want, you could go to the freaking movie theater and see the JSA with Black Adam. You could watch him in Stargirl. You could see him in Smallville. Lots of cartoons. I mean, they're finally getting known out there in the general populace, and that's super exciting for me.
Two notes. Don't go watch them in Black Adam. And
I made that mistake, actually, a few weeks ago.
Don't do that. And then on the inset, I love that Mike Paraback worked in the JSA robot butler, Gernsback. I just think that's – I love that detail from Roy Thomas because that was invented in All-Star Squadron. And so I love that he's included here. I just think that's just a fun little detail.
I've been reading it on the DC Infinite app because they just loaded those issues up recently. And it's just such a fun series. It's so good. All right. Up next is maybe not quite as interesting.
From the sublime to the ridiculous is but a step.
So we've talked many times about the Legion acronym series. Well, this is acronym Legion. It's the Legion recruits. Okay. But Legion is an acronym. And recruits is an acronym. And I'm just going to put it out there. Come on. That is going too far to come up with an acronym for Registered Experimental Class Regiment Under Initial Trainee Status. Seriously?
The series that hates the readers.
I'm going to be straight up, folks. The Legion series, as much as I kind of liked early days, I kind of lost touch with it. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. But you've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 characters here. One of them is the blue chick who looks a lot like Ice Maiden. She looks like she's wearing Ice's costume in the Justice League, and she's got the skin color of Ice Maiden. So that's a little confusing with the white hair. Then you got Lydia Malor, who is sort of kind of the inspiration for Shadowlast in the future, but it's like a retroactive thing. Then you got a whole bunch of other people that we've never heard from again, and who, you know, one guy looks like Tyr, the action figure from Superpowers. I don't have much more to say about this other than it's Barry Kitson, and I do like Barry Kitson art, and they do look great, and they do, you know, I love their proportions. I love the styling of it. I don't have anything in me for these characters. Please help.
I have taken so much shit from you people in the last 12 years for not liking the Legion. And then you look at these listings, and can you blame me? Can you blame me?
Okay, this is the acronym Legion. That's different.
I know that. I'm just saying. Just look at that. Just every listing in every Legion listing to me in this whole series has just been such a downer. Gray, ugly tones, hideous, ungainly acronyms. It's just like, oh my God. Like, and everybody's mad. It's just like, what is this?
One guy's smiling.
Oh my god. Okay.
So the border is red for hero team in training. First appearance is Legion 91 number 30. So at this point, they've been around for about 19 issues because Legion, acronym Legion's on issue number 49. And if you want more on them, you can check out the Legion of Super Bloggers. I swear someone's doing an acronym Legion podcast, and I just couldn't find it when I was Googling, because Google, by the way, ignores periods. So when I'm typing L period, E period, G period, whatever, it just looked for the word Legion and everything, and I couldn't find it, so I apologize.
I learned that the hard way with Mashcast.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah. Now, as much as we're bagging on this, I do realize these characters mean something to someone, and that's great. And I'm happy that you love these characters, and that's awesome. They just don't resonate with us. So please don't hate us for not having any connection to it. So it's sort of like when Rob goes on and on about Aquaman stuff. You know, we all just sort of tune them out. Up next is Lex Luthor II. So this is the son of Lex Luthor, who was raised in Australia. He's got long flowing red hair. He's got the red beard without a mustache, sort of an Amish thing looking on. It's a picture here by Jackson Geis and Dennis Rodier. And it's got young Lex Luthor II as he's in his 20s and he's wearing a business suit, and he's a giant painting of his father behind him. And there's a globe there. So what do you think? And then, yeah, the font is just a font, but what do you think of the image?
It's nice. I mean, it's, you know, obviously a riff on the Earth 3 Luthor from the crime syndicate world of Luthor, right?
That's with the red hair?
Yeah, with the red hair. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, they established that his dad had red hair when he's younger, though, too.
Oh, okay. Oh, well, all right. Okay. Well, all right. I guess so. I guess that makes sense. Yeah, I don't really know anything about this. I didn't. Mm-hmm. I was shocked to see Supergirl kind of canoodling with him there in the
set
on the back. I didn't know about any of that. So, yeah, I didn't know they did any of this, really.
Okay.
This is all kind of new to me.
So at this point, this character had been around for about 15 months. So he shows up. Luthor dies, you know, because Luthor was dying of kryptonite poisoning. And he goes off an experimental plane. The plane crashes. He dies. So Lex Luthor was dead. Then his will gets read, and it reveals that he had a son that was being raised in Australia secretly. He was in his 20s. So he comes back to the United States, and he takes over LexCorp. He's a really nice guy. He's got a thick Australian accent. Everyone loves him. Superman and Lois kind of like keep an eye on him, but they're like, okay, this guy's a pretty good guy. Then after about 8 months of this, of thinking Lex Luthor 2 was really nice, we find out that no, he's evil. And he's actually Lex Luthor Sr. Literally the cover is one of my favorite covers of all time. It's so funny. Big bold letters. It shows him, but it says, they saved Luthor's brain.
Oh, is that that? That's, yeah. I've seen that cover. Okay.
Yeah. It's so retro 50s. It's awesome. So yes, Luthor faked his death. They removed his brain and part of his spinal column, and they grew a new young, healthy body around him because he was dying of poisoning, radiation poisoning. And he grew basically grew himself a son with his own brain. And, you know, also he very specifically programmed it so he'd have hair. That was a big issue. He wanted lots and lots of hair. And he goes there, and assumes the role of his son, takes over his companies. And again, for 8 months, we all thought he was a nice guy, but behind the scenes, he's being a prick. And then it's revealed that he's really his dad. And this whole time, yeah, he's not just canoodling with Supergirl. Him, that's the Matrix Supergirl, by the way. There's some kinky stuff going on with her doing some shape changing, just like every man would fantasize about. Yeah, they showed us that was going on. Which is a little uncomfortable for many of us.
I'd love to know what Ange feels about that.
Right? Yeah, I bet. So I loved this idea of this secretly being evil, you know, and all the, like, there's this great scene where he's standing over Superman's grave and he's just like, you're dead. He's just, like, screaming at Superman, just berating his dead body. I mean, wow, it's powerful. So at this point, again, Superman had only been dead for 3 weeks at this point. And so the writer here is Roger Stern, because of course he was writing a lot of the Superman comics. Border is black for villain, and first appearance is Action Comic. Now it's interesting, because they have revealed in this entry that it is actually Lex Luthor Sr. I mean, the mystery is already out, and it says so in the entry. So the first appearance, I feel like they should have listed Luthor's original first appearance, not just Lex Luthor the second appearance. But
interesting. Okay.
Yes, different body, whatever.
Right. And it's a known relative, father in quotes, deceased in quotes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, the back's got him hanging out with, what's his, Dr. Hamilton, Emil Hamilton, and it's got him. I think that could be him giving a press conference for LexCorp, but it looks more like him at a funeral giving a eulogy or something for Superman. But Anyway, I like this entry, and I love this version of Lex Luthor. And the if you get the audio book thing, the audio drama for the death, it was called Superman Lives. It was all about the death of Superman and his return. It was done in the 90s. Like, the guy does this really over-the-top Australian accent for Lex Luthor II, and it's hysterical. I adore it. All right, up next is The Linear Men. And this is a fun concept. The idea was, and I don't know if Dan I'm going to credit Dan Jurgens, but I don't know if that's fair or not. It was Adventures of Superman, so it's his time. You know, that was his book for a long time. The idea was they're basically time travel cops. They protect the timeline. And there's in this case, on the front, we've got Dan Jurgens and Trevor Scott drew three individuals. I'm a little unclear on who all of them are. I know it's Leary Lee is the girl. I know that much. And by the way, just going to say it, she's smoking hot. The other two people, I'm pretty sure one of them is Matthew Ryder, who, by the way, in the alternate timeline became Wave Rider for Armageddon 2001. And the other one, I'm pretty sure, is Rip Hunter. It could alternatively, it could be another Matthew Ryder. I'm not entirely sure. It gets a little confusing. But behind them are all these great time travel things. Like, you see the Wright Brothers plane. You see other attempts at planes. You see like a dirigible. You see a Air Force jet. You see a space shuttle. So what do you think of the art here?
It's fine. I mean, it's Dan Jurgens. That's always nice, but it's, you know, we can't help it. I can't help it. I mean, this is the 90s, and this stuff just doesn't appeal to me. This overly designed, overly, you know, everybody's just got so many accessories. It just kind of, but I mean, it is not a bad concept. I have to say, I've never heard of these guys. Okay. And I did read the entry because I was kind of intrigued about what's all the stuff in the back. Like, what's all the history of, mm-hmm. you know, in flight and stuff. But yeah, I just wish their uniforms weren't so kind of just overdone. This is like a lot.
Think about the action figure potential, Rob. They're very toyetic.
they are very toyetic, yes.
So here's the thing. They are kind of sort of TV stars, because the Legends of Tomorrow series is all about them traveling through time and protecting the timeline.
Wow.
It's basically based on the Linear Men. I can't remember if they say the name Linear Men or not. Oh, I should know. I watched a whole bunch of the show. But their base is called the Vanishing Point of the Linear Men in the comics, and that is absolutely what the time travel group's base was in Legends of Tomorrow, was the Vanishing Point. So it's a fun concept. Again, I'm a time travel nut, so I love this kind of stuff. So I love the concept behind it. And here's something about Dan Jurgens. I like scratchier inkers for Dan. Like, in this case, this guy, Trevor Scott, I don't know that I've seen a lot of stuff inking Dan. You usually get, like, Bread Breeding, which gets you very smooth, thick lines. I like the scratcher inking on Jurgens. I think it looks really sharp. Like, I like this. I like it when Art T. Bear used to ink him. I like this kind of look. So, and you do have a logo, by the way. Kind of, sort of.
Sort of.
Yep. So, fun concept. The writer is Roger Stern here. First appearance is Adventure Superman number 476. Border is red for Hero Team. Again, if you want more, watch Legends of Tomorrow. So, pretty cool stuff. All right, up next is The Lurker, which is another font that is impossible to read. It's all white over, like, yellow. It's really, really hard to read. This is a creature sort of thing, kind of a Cthulhu crazy monster that is a mashup of two faces. Basically, half the face is supposed to be Jason Blood. The other half is supposed to be Etrigan. But these faces have been stitched together with bone-like claws. They have all these creepy claws and tentacles and spikes coming out of it. Very demonic, very monstrous. And in its clutches, they're holding a Jason Blood and an Etrigan. And it's very, talk about overly rendered. It's very goopy and skeletal sort of kind of thing. And kind of Cthulhu-ish. I don't know. What do you think?
I like the artwork. It's Val Simicus.
Yep, and Carl Kiesel, who's, by the way, Carl Kiesel's not credited again, but you can see Carl's signature directly under Val's.
Okay. Yeah, it's very nice. The Lurker thing is just, they kind of threw it in there at the last second. But artwork-wise, it's terrific. And I love all the jokes on the backside with the alter ego, that which lurks, the lurking one, old Lurky.
Yeah.
You know, that stuff. Like, I mean, I never read the Steven series, but it's considering, like, the Kirby one is so serious, it's fun that they did, like, a humor version of it. And you see there's a giant eyeball flying over demons. So it kind of makes me want to check this series out, to be honest with you, because I kind of like that sort of comedy mixed with supernatural horror. Like, I'm down for that. So this looks fun.
We've said this on the podcast before. I mean, Demon is one of the only series in the 90s I didn't read, you know, either at first run or in rerun. So it's sort of like, it'd be new to me. So maybe I don't know. I've heard such mixed things from people. Some people say, oh, you absolutely got to read it. And then I've heard people say, no, don't waste your time. But it's Alan Grant and Val Zemeckis. I like both of them. So, you know, anyway. Yeah, the tongue is definitely planted firmly in the cheek in this entry. There's a lot of funny bits in here. The idea was it was this entity, this creature, the demon, whatever, who was trying to replace Jason and Etrigan the Demon. It was created by the very fact that they were a union. Like 1,000 years ago, when they were merged, this thing started being created and eventually gained consciousness more recently. And it's essentially one of those ideas. It's a construct that's given form by their thoughts kind of thing, you know, the typical in horror kind of stuff. It was appeared in Demon number 21. Right now, they are 10 months after that, after his first appearance. So right now, they're on Demon 31 on the shelves. And the writer for this one is Dan Raspler, and the border is black for villain. The art didn't work for me as much as it did you. But again, I am interested in checking out the Demon series. All right. Up next is New Earth. Okay. Rob, you talk about how much you don't like the Legion, right? But this is an entry showing you a kind of a space station. It's a bunch of not geodesic domes, but a bunch of domed cities floating in space that have been attached together like a giant space station. There's a ship flying by. There's, you know, another shuttle kind of there as well. The art is by Stuart Immonone and ink by Ray McCarthy. Artistically, what do you think?
It's fine. There's really, how much could somebody make this interesting looking? And mm-hmm. It's just a space station. It's nicely drawn.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just kind of like, oh, okay. All right. I mean, I like the inset panels of see the planet exploding and then there's like this half thing. That's cool. Again, I didn't know anything about this, but you know, I mean, I'm glad that DC did these. They did the Batcave. They would do, Atlantis. So then they, you know, geography's part of it. So yeah, why not? But yeah, it didn't do much for me. It's just kind of like, I wish maybe there'd been some figures in there just to give it some scale or something, or showing the Legion flying around this thing, or just something with a little more action to it, as opposed to just like, okay, it's just the ships are just sitting there. Like, all right, that's cool.
They really should have put the Legionnaires on here to help sell it. You're right. Now this is another extremely timely thing. Like New Earth was just created 2 months prior to this hitting the shelves. So that's how new Earth is. So I'm going to tell you a little bit of the history here, and I may get a little emotional. So forgive me. So basically what happens is Earth has an ecological disaster in the 31st century or 30th century. It's a combination of ecological issues and man's own mistreatment of the planet. It catches up with it, and Earth is destroyed, which is what you're seeing on the back, is the Earth being destroyed, which really sucks because that's where I keep all my stuff. So what happens is humans, the refugee, they escape the Earth. So they launch tons and tons of cities into space. Like literally a whole city is launched into space. And they end up linking together 94 cities, and 50 million people stay to populate these cities after the Earth's been destroyed and is now known as New Earth. You know, hangs out in our orbit where Earth normally was. And the whole idea behind this was to create a setting for the new Legionnaires book. So Legion, like we'd had Legion of Superheroes for however many months, or I guess 38 months or whatever. And now they were the Legionnaires, which was the young version of Legion, are going to get their own series, and they were all going to be hanging out on New Earth. And so that's why you've got this sort of setting. But man, issue number 38, where this happens, Legion of Superheroes number 38, folks, go read. And even you, Rob, I would recommend you read this comic. It is a tearjerker. All right. It's kind of like a novella. Really, because what, like every page is, it's not a comic book. It's a big batch of text and then like one single image on each page. Hmm. So it's like reading a text piece with just some sparse images. And it tells this incredibly tragic tale about why the Earth ended up exploding. It talks about the escape. It talks about the refugees, and it talks about, sadly, the 2 billion people left behind on the Earth to die. They couldn't get off the planet in time. And it even features this incredibly powerful cameo of Sandman's death. You know, Death from Sandman, she's in a Legion comic. She's in the background standing over all the 2 billion people while they die, as Earth dies. And it's incredibly powerful. And I'm not exaggerating. I have these big notes explaining everything about it, right? And I literally wrote in my notes, I am crying while I write these notes. I mean, like it affected me remembering that comic so much that I was tearing up while I was writing these notes the other night. So Legion of Superheroes number 38, I cannot recommend highly enough you read it. It's incredibly powerful. It tells you the whole story right there. You don't need to know a lot of the history to read it. So When this issue of Who's Who hit the stands, the Earth had been destroyed 2 months prior, and 2 months in the future, Legionnaires number one would be published. So it's like sits right squarely in the middle of the destruction of Earth and the new series starting. So the writer here is Tom and Mary Beerbohm, so you know it's written within an inch of its life. First appearance, again, is Legion of Super is number 38. The border is green for geography. We don't get a lot of those. And if you want more, you can check out the Legion of Super bloggers, or probably their animated movies and all that other stuff. I don't know if they would have New Earth in it, but, you know, you get Legion content. All right, up next is Oa, the Mosaic World. So the art here is by Cully Hamner and Carl Story, and what you've got is John Stewart sitting on a bizarre sort of throne of living bone, maybe living stone. I don't know.
I'm like, when did John Stewart join the Doom Patrol? When did that start?
I'm glad you brought that up. So we'll talk about that in just a second. So he's sitting on a chair that's alive. He's surrounded by like a bird person and these three triplicate women and these young girls that look like they stepped out of The Shining and a being that's made up of eyeballs and really weird, weird Doom Patrol kind of stuff going on here and some Lilliputian people down by his feet. And what the deal here is, this started in the Green Lantern series. So Green Lantern got a new series after Emerald Dawn. And you remember Old Timer, the guy that traveled around with Hal and Ollie when they went around, the hard traveling heroes?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. Well, he goes insane. He goes crazy. And he ends up creating, what's that?
Okay.
Yep. And he ends up creating this patchwork world. He literally rips cities out of the surfaces of various planets around the universe and pulls them together.
And he sends them into outer space, right? Okay, yeah. I'm following.
Yep. And he makes this patchwork world, just like Secret Wars, basically. He makes a patchwork world from all over these planets, and Old Timer's crazy, and they end up defeating him. But the planet remains. And the Guardians say, actually, you know what? We want to study this planet to see how people get along and how to help people get along better. And John Stewart agrees to stay behind, sort of keep the peace. And that's what this series was. It was John overseeing this crazy planet full of bizarrely different people. So the series, again, it features great art by Cully Hamner, some great ideas in there. John Stewart, this is the first time John Stewart ever headlined a series, really, for any period of time. You know, he finally gets a chance to be the headliner. I take that back. He was the headliner in Green Lantern in the old days, too, for a while, but it always felt like he was just waiting for Hal to come back, really, in those cases. But this launched as John's series. Ultimately, only lasted 18 issues. At this point, they're on issue number 9. This series is beloved by many, many fans for being very edgy and very different. My controversial opinion is kind of goes in line with what you just said. I personally think the series is very overrated. Okay. It's a great concept, great ideas. The art's amazing, right? But it read like someone trying to ape Grant Morrison's Doom Patrol. It's exactly what it reads like. He did it more successfully than Rachel Pollack did on the Doom Patrol series, in my opinion, but it's an inferior copy of Morrison's Doom Patrol. And as you can read this entry with all these different aliens, a lot of it's just weirdness for weirdness sake, and it doesn't land well. And I, as much as I wanted to love it, I didn't by the end. Like, did you read the entry by just out of curiosity?
I did. I mean, again, they are throwing a lot at you. You know, the weary ones, a culture so old that it sags spiritually under its own hysterical weight. Like, you're like, what the hell?
Yep.
But okay. You know, like I've never been a big Green Lantern fan. I've never been a big fan of the Green Lantern Corps. Ironically enough, the stuff I love the most were those Tales of Oa backups.
Sure.
Tales of the Green Lantern Corps.
Yeah. Yeah.
Backups where they got to kind of do a little different kind of stuff. Alan Moore would do some and they would just do different things. And this sounds like a little more in line with that. So I didn't know that that's what this was. I remember there being a Mosaic series, but I thought it was just kind of more Green Lantern adventures. I didn't know it was anything like this. So
okay. It gets weird. Like at one point, John eats the ring. he becomes a guardian at one point. I mean, it's just so weird. And I wanted to love it, but I couldn't. Maybe you folks at home, let me know. Did you love the series? And if you did, that's okay. We can have different opinions. It's not a problem. I love the idea. I didn't love the execution. So, the text here was written by Gerard Jones, who was the writer on the series as well. The border is green for geography. And if you want more on them, you know, check out the Lantern Cast with our buddy Chad Bokelman.
I just thought it was funny that you said in the previous listing, it's geography. We don't get many of those. And then it's the very next one. It's also geography.
Well, we don't get many of those. But anyway, up next is an utterly bizarre entry. It's Ramona, who is a supporting character, at least at this point, and I think a very short-lived supporting character, unless I'm mistaken, in the Lobo miniseries that we get published at the time. The cover is by Simon Bisley. Again, it's just a font. It looks like it's a handwriting, but I know that. That's just a font. But it's got some fun stuff in there. She's got a big sign that says Ramona's Bail Bonded Unisex Salon. You've got Lobo in the background just sitting there looking like he's tired of waiting. You've got, you know, booze on the floor and glasses, and she's got scissors because she does hairstyle. And she looks like a woman who really overdoes it. Like, you know, her hair's all teased up. She's got tons of jewelry. She's wearing a big old colorful, you know, dress of some sort. I don't love Simon Bisley all the time, but this is cute, I guess.
Since the last episode of Who's Who, I have been to Sedona, Arizona.
Oh,
there are a lot of women like this that out there.
Okay, well, there you go. So that's what you're looking at here, folks. And it's written kind of funny. Dan Rassler wrote it. There's some funny stuff in here, like, you know, her weight. It says, none of your damn business, you know. What else? Her alter ego, yo, Ramona. You know, some cute stuff. Later on, it talks about Lobo, and it gives a little credit. It says, see Lobo, Who's Who, issue number 8. Though if you don't know who Lobo is, you're probably not going to be reading this, right? Anyway, you know, it's kind of funny. The whole idea behind Ramona's bail bond and unisex salon's cute. Like, she has hair gel that's made up from recovered bail jumpers. So, like, you know, she does bail. Lobo goes and collects bail bond people for her and stuff like that. Her first appearance was Lobo's Back number 1, which was I didn't write down how long ago it was, but this is, you know, I did. It was about 8 months ago. And the thing was, when Lobo came out, it was just a series of miniseries. It was like Lobo for 4 issues, and then Lobo's Back for 4 issues, and then, I don't know, something else. And then what was on the shelf at this point was Lobo Infanticide. Issue number 4 is where they were right now. So basically, my take on this is it's a funny entry. It's cute for a character that I can't even remember. So I can't imagine she was used a lot after this.
Probably not. Probably not.
And if she was, then I'm just wrong. So
nice artwork, though.
Yeah, it's fun. Of all the Simon Bisley stuff we've suffered through in this in the loose leaf, I like this one. So
yeah.
Supporting cast is The Border and written by Dan Rassler. So, all right. Coming up next is, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, oh my gosh. It is The Ray by Joe Quesada and Art Nichols. And this is, I wish they'd use some different colors because the art is gorgeous. The red is a little too overpowering for the background, but it is Ray. We're talking, Ray Terrell, the 90s Ray, and he's in his sort of marching band top and his white pants, and he's got the helmet on, and there's all these energy crackling around him because it's Joe Quesada. Of course, it's, you know, overdone beyond the belief with the Ray logo behind him. But, again, imagine the red a little less overpowering. What do you think of this?
I like it. I think it's just a little too over rendered, like just too much stuff, you know, but it's a very 90s uniform. I love the logo. I just noticed that there's the figure of the Ray in the logo. I never noticed that before. That's sharp. I like that a lot. So yeah, it's cool, but it's like a little, like, just scale it back a little bit.
Again, I think if the red had been brought down to a less offensive color, I think this would have worked a lot.
Just a lot of motion, just a lot of the crackling energy, and then the things, and then the stuff coming out from the sun kind of behind it. Just like, just a lot.
Yeah. Now on the back cover, you get to see what he looks like when he's flying, which I've always loved. His whole, other than his jacket, everything turns black silhouette, which looks great. And that helmet looks awesome in silhouette. The energy field around him is always square edged. So I just love that look for him. And then the idea here is that, as a child, he was told that he was allergic to sunlight and that it would kill him. But the reality was his parents were lying to him. Instead, he had light-based powers. He absorbed sunlight and then radiated out. So the image on the bottom left, what you're seeing is they lit a birthday cake for him, and the light from the candles energized him. And he's, like, you know, crackling with energy because he absorbed sunlight from the, you know, light energy from the candles, which was just crazy.
Candle maker.
Oh my gosh. So what, you know, I wonder, you know, first of all, Joe Quesada, let's talk about that for a second. You know, a huge Marvel executive for 22 years, from the year 2000 all the way to 2022, you know, editor in chief, executive vice president, et cetera, here designing a DC character in the 90s, which is just really a unique sort of situation. I love it. I do wonder, cause the Ray kind of disappears after a while, even though he was pretty big for a while. He kind of, DC always likes to have a teenage popular character, like Firestorm was it for a while, the It character. The Ray was the It character for a while. But I wonder if having a co-creator of Joe Quesada was problematic for DC, you know, as they got into the 2000s. I wonder if that was an issue for them.
Why?
Because he was the editor-in-chief of their competitor.
Well, yeah, but they still get to, it's still their character. I mean,
yeah, but they got to mail him, they got to mail him a check.
So what? Oh, come on. DC Marvel go back and forth. So, I mean, okay. Good Lord.
All right. Maybe I'm wrong. Okay. So the writer here, co-creator, is Jack C. Harris, who, by the way, was the editor on Firestorm number one all the way back in 1977, which is really cool. And I love that this was creating the legacy, you know, the Freedom Fighters legacy. We had the Ray. We talked about Black Condor last episode. They had done Damage around this time. You know, so they were really building this Freedom Fighters legacy, which I absolutely loved. So, okay, growing up, he thinks he's allergic to sunlight. Turns out it's not really. He absorbs light because he is the son of the 1940s, the Ray, the one who's part of the Freedom Fighters. Then they go into this, quite frankly, overly convoluted retcon for the 1940s Ray about how the way he got his powers, and it was all to stop this universal light entity. And they knew that the Ray's child would be able to liaison with this entity. Again, it's really kind of confusing, but by the end of it, get past the universal light and anything, and you get this really cool new character. It's bottom line. You get this really new cool character. He's 18 years old. He's got great powers. Visually, he's totally kick ass. You know, he can fly. He can absorb energy. He can blast stuff. He can create his uniform. He can manipulate energy. Lots and lots and lots of great stuff. Great character. Lots of promise. At this point, he is literally one month away from joining the Justice League. So he joins the Justice League. Like after Superman dies, they sort of go on a recruitment binge and they recruit Agent Liberty. They recruit Black Condor. They recruit the Ray, and somebody else. And I'm forgetting who. Ooh, gosh.
Somebody else from the Freedom Fighters?
No, I should remember who it is. I can't remember. Now I'm really embarrassed. Oh, well. Anyway, and not only was he about to join the JLA, they were, and they even talk about this in the inset, the letters page. They do something very unusual for DC in the 1990s. They were producing a trade paperback for the first Ray miniseries. Which, you know, 92, they weren't doing many trade paperbacks. So that's how big they saw him as being. He gets his own ongoing series a little bit later after this. It was okay. And it didn't perform all that well. So he eventually ends up becoming like a minor character on various teams. Like he's on the JLA. Later he joins Young Justice. He joins the Freedom Fighters. He shows up for crossovers and stuff. And then he disappears. This is like gone for years and years and years. Then they brought him back in the year 2016 as an LGBTQ character, and even went on to appear in the Arrowverse. And so he was in the Arrowverse TV shows, and he even got his own cartoon on the CW Seed, which is a network most people don't even know exist. But CW has Seed, and he had an animated cartoon starring him that was all tied into the Arrowverse stuff, which was pretty cool.
Wow.
So based on your comment before, I think I know how you're going to answer this question, but I was going to pose the question for the listeners at home. Is the Ray the best looking new character design of the 1990s? I think he might be.
I'd have to think about who else was in the 1990s. I just think it's over designed.
Well, okay. But look at the black. The way you normally saw him was the black silhouette though.
That looks cool. I'll admit that looks cool, but but that's not his main look. His main look is with the Sergeant Pepper thing.
Well,
he's got that from the Dark Stars.
Look at the class picture. Look at his class picture by his name. Look at that one with the helmet.
That's cool. The helmet looks good. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
so you can ignore the front drawing, because I don't think the front drawing is representative of enough of his look. Cause you're right. It's very, very busy.
Okay. Yeah. No, it looks pretty. It does look pretty cool. And it's neat that they, you know, that these concepts, the Freedom Fighters, they could redo some of them and get new life out of them, you know?
Yep. They didn't do enough with the Freedom Fighters idea. They really should have given them their own book with the Ray and Black Condor and Damage and all those. They didn't. Instead, they stuck them in Infinity, Infinite Crisis, and then they killed them off and then replaced them, and it was a mess. But I actually have an action figure of this Ray, and it's in my shelf of 90s characters, and I absolutely love it, so. Writer here is Jack C. Harris. Border is red for Hero. First appearance is the Ray miniseries, February 1992. So, I had a lot to say. Now, you and I, we talked about him on a JSA Presents episode. I did a huge long character spotlight on him because I'm so excited by this character. Love it, love it, love it.
No historical first appearance.
Well, this one is, to be fair, this should say Ray the Second. This is not a retcon of the character. This is his son.
Right. Right.
So they shouldn't. So I would say historical appearance isn't relevant here, but they should say the Ray 2 should be fair, because
right,
he is the son of the original Ray. So
right,
that's fair.
Right. Okay.
Speaking of characters that Rob loves, up next is the Team Titans. There's your sci, folks. Art again by Kev Maguire and Will Blyberg. So let's talk about the art rather than the characters for a minute. So you got all five characters, almost like a Teen Vogue close-up shot. They're all, you know, like Mirage is kind of giving your like puffy lips posing thing. Terra looks a little angry. Kilowatt's like, why am I here? The vampire guy, whatever his name is, Knight Rider is a rah. And then the girl, Red Wing, is all smiley and stuff. So, like, what do you think of the image?
The artwork is great because, of course, it is. But these just look like such a bunch of morts. I'm sorry. This is just, yeah, no.
I argue that every superhero looks like a mort until you read adventures that you like of them. Like the new Teen Titans, Changeling, you know, honestly, he looks like a mort until you get to know the character and you're like, oh no, he's awesome. You know, like I think every superhero looks ridiculous until they have a chance to find their legs and become popular. So I don't think there's anything wrong with Mirage's design. I don't think there's anything wrong with any of their design. Kilowatt looks great. I think Red Wing looks a little crazy with the hair. But I think all of them, if they had the right story, could have hit. And maybe because I was living in the moment, I was ready for them to be the next big thing. Maybe I'm biased here. So we actually covered them not too long ago in the scheme of this podcast because they were in the last set of Who's Who. And there they appeared as the Teen Titans prior to them getting their own series. And then once they tried to do that, DC found out they couldn't launch a book called Teen Titans for whatever reason. At least that's the story I had always heard.
So really? I never heard that.
I don't know if it's apocryphal or not. I've never done the research on it. I had heard they couldn't do a Teen Titans book for whatever reason, so they had to call it Team Titans. I don't know. Somebody tell me if that's BS or not, but that's what I always heard. So they launched Team Titans. So the idea here is if the new Titans or the new Teen Titans were the X-Men of the 80s, right? That was DC's X-Men. Then the Team Titans is the X-Force. That's what they're trying to, chase that heat. In fact, editorial wanted a X-Force comic for DC, and that's what this was supposed to be. Whereas the writers wanted to do something entirely different, which, by the way, becomes a huge problem. So, to cover this as quick as I can, they're from an alternate future where, that Donna Troy's child grows up to be this evil god, insane with power and ambition. He becomes this character named Lord Chaos, and he controls the world as a tyrant. And one former hero, member of the Teen Titans, is secretly resisting. And this mystery person, who we didn't know until the very end, gathered hundreds and hundreds of superpowered kids and formed them into different groups called Team Titans. So these hundreds of kids are split into like six-person groups of Team Titans. So they all go battle Lord Chaos in the year 2001. Oh, you remember it well. And then they end up getting this group, this six particular, or five here, I guess, end up getting flung back to the past. And so they're settled in, you know, 1992, and they're trying to figure out how to make their way, and they're settling into as heroes of today, kind of the junior team to the Teen Titans, which is kind of ironic. The new Titans have their own teen sidekicks now, right? So here's the gimmick thing about this. It was so 90s. So issue number one had five different versions, okay?
Of course.
Of course it did. And rather than going the Marvel route of just having a different cover, it did have five different covers, but they also had five different eight-page backups. So like if you bought the issue with Kilowatt on the cover, you got an eight-page backup with Kilowatt. If you bought the issue with Mirage on the cover, you got an eight-page backup with Mirage. So you had to buy all five versions to get the full story. Quite the clever move by DC, because it got all my money, that's for sure. But the book was a disaster. It really was. Marv Wolfman was going through a writer's block period. He didn't stay on the book very long. The people who took over, again, editorial wanted X-Force. The writers who took over wanted Doom Patrol. And it just didn't work. And everyone acknowledged that this book was a complete mess. It lasted only 24 issues. At this point, number five is only on the shelf. So at this point, we're all still young and hopeful and think it could really work out. That did not happen.
He's young and hopeful.
Well, I mean, again, I thought these were, I mean, think about how big the Teen Titans were, right? In the 80s. I don't know if I really thought, but I wanted these guys to be the next big thing, right? I thought, you know, there's a chance here. This could happen. You know, why not? Why not these kids? And, why not? Because no one could write them very well. So writer of this entry is Warren Wolfen. The border is Red for Hero Team. First appearance is New Titans Annual number 7. It doesn't list the date, but it was just a year or two before this. And if you want more, you can listen to the Titan Up the Defense podcast or, again, Pop Culture Affidavit with our buddy Tom Panarese. Beautiful Kevin Maguire art, though. I mean, just absolutely stunning. All right, up next, is Thrust. What a terrible name. Okay. So I think this will be brief. It's drawn by Joe Phillips, who I really, really like. In fact, he was on the JLI podcast. He's a really nice guy, super great guy. Him and Al Gordon. Al Gordon was the writer. He was the artist. They did a miniseries all about, and you and I talked about this last time, all about Timberwolf, where Timberwolf became this feral looking kind of.
Oh, right, right, right.
He sent him back to the 20th century, and he gets kind of hooked up with this guy, Thrust. And he does have a cool logo. Looks very skate rat. You know, it's got a skull on it.
Yes. Yeah.
Which is what he's supposed to be. He's a skateboarder. That's right. What this dude is. Right. Yeah. Right. He's, you know, he's probably gnarly, you know, kind of thing. And in the 20th century here, Thrust is part of this team of, you know, aliens doing Black Ops missions. They're called Point Force. Bear in mind, the year before, Point Break had come out. So that is
that
not
an acronym? Point Force, no. period, O, period.
No, but it's clearly a play on Point Break. So again, Timberwolf, it was Al Gordon's project to make a young, cool animal Wolverine kind of character. Didn't catch on. I'm not going to spend any more time on Thrust here. The entry, though, is fun. It's written with some snark, which is kind of funny, which makes it cute. Al Gordon wrote the entry himself. So I enjoyed the snarkiness of it. And Joe Phillips' art looks great. So, all right, talk to me about the art here. So other than it being extremely 90s, you know, what do you think?
I actually like this.
Good.
Because it's Legion, which is like, bleh, but it's fun.
Yeah.
It's fun. It's not just dour people standing in gray backgrounds. Mm-hmm. You know, there's some color. I like the stripes on the inside of his coat.
Yeah.
Like that looks really cool. The logo is very, very, you know, graffiti kind of thing. I like the skull kind of shoulder pad that he's got. I mean, look, am I going to go find a comic starring this character and read it? No, I'm not. I'm not going to make that kind of effort. But it looks fun and futuristic and goofy. And it just, to me, it stands in stark contrast to every other Legion entry I've seen in this series, which is just so goddamn dour. So I'm okay with this. I'm like, all right, fun. Looks cool.
I really wanted this series to work. It just unfortunately didn't. So, you know, I just realized another artist credit mistake. So the back, it only credits it to Joe Phillips, but Al Gordon signed it as an inker. So clearly
It says text and inks, Al Gordon.
Oh, I didn't notice that. Ah,
the only time, I think, where it mentions the writer and the inker is the same person.
Yeah. And look at Rob actually reading an entry. That's amazing.
There you go. And a Legion one on top of it.
Border is red for heroes. Legion of Superheroes annual is first appearance. And as we said, Al wrote it. So Timberwolf was on issue number 3 at this point. So
doesn't he look a little like Wildfire when Wildfire became like a person? Didn't Wildfire like finally get out of his suit or something? Am I thinking of somebody else?
He did. He had like a body of sorts that Giffen would draw. No.
Or am I wrong? Maybe
I'm
thinking.
You're wrong. But
okay.
That's fine.
All right.
You're allowed to be wrong. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Up next is Peter Cannon. Did you just curse at me? I think
no.
I thought I heard the F word. Okay.
No. I said fair.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. All right. Up next is very exciting. Peter Cannon Thunderbolt supporting cast.
Good Lord.
How exciting.
So, a character we don't own.
Well, so that is part of the story I'm going to share. So text and pencils are by Mike Collins, who was doing the series at the time. And Jose Marzan Jr. was the inker. So real quickly, I did some research on this about that whole ownership issue. So apparently DC did have the rights at this point to do Peter Cannon Thunderbolt. So they did the 12-issue series. It didn't do very well, so it got canceled. He then showed up in a couple of Justice League quarterlies. Then very quickly afterwards, they did lose the rights. They did revert back to the owner, or technically his estate. And so,
Pete Morisi.
Okay, there you go. Mm-hmm. And they lost the rights. I didn't write down the name. So, and then actually recently Dynamite published some Peter Cannon Thunderbolt stuff. And apparently, our friends have been saying it's very, very good. So, interesting thing. This is the thing I didn't know. When the creator, what was his name again?
I think it's Pete or Pat Morisi. Morisi is the last name. Yep. Blanking on the first name.
So when he wanted to do this series originally in the 60s, he didn't want to do it first his own character. He tried to buy the rights to the original Golden Age Daredevil. You remember the Daredevil?
Yeah, the red and blue guy. Yeah.
Yeah. And so when he didn't get the rights, he created Peter Cannon Thunderbolt. And if you look, the costume is very similar to Daredevil on purpose.
Yeah, I guess it is. You're right. He doesn't have a hood on, but it's the same color scheme. And
right.
Yeah.
The split. I never knew that. So I'm like, oh, that's sort of interesting. And of course, if you're a Watchmen fan, you know, Ozymandias is based on Peter Cannon Thunderbolt.
Right.
So.
Right.
But unfortunately, all of this makes me now talk about his supporting cast, which I'm not going to do. There are four friends here. I'm not even going to bother to name him. But in the Thunderbolt series, he was
one of them is Gypsy, apparently.
Which one?
The one that looks like Gypsy.
Oh, okay. Oh my, she does a little bit. You're right, with glasses. Oh my god, it's terrible. So in the series, Thunderbolt was also always battling this organization called Scorpio. So in this listing is a woman named Cairo DeFray, who becomes Peter Cannon Thunderbolt's girlfriend, his love interest. You know, she's sexy on the front. She's got kind of the 80s businesswoman model kind of look going. And it turns out that she is the head of Scorpio. Dun, dun, dun. So she was the evil one right there the whole time. So Peter Cannon Thunderbolt is on issue number 6 of 12 at this point when this was published. This is, again, written and penciled by Mike Collins. Border is blue for supporting cast, and that's all we're going to say about that.
I have stayed away from these details throughout this issue. You're welcome, everybody. But I got to mention, Cairo DeFray, height 6 feet, weight 105 pounds. That is dead. That is dead. You do not have enough strength to walk around and do stuff when you are that bone thin. So somebody went, I know she's a fashion model, and we know that they are all too skinny, or at least they used to be. You know, they're all that whole waif thing, but good Lord, 6 feet, 105. That's no internal organs left.
Mike Collins did draw her very thin on the cover, but still, anyway.
But yeah.
Now, by contrast, the next image by Jerome K. Moore, and you better not laugh right now.
No, you're not.
Yes, Jerome K. Moore drew an incredible image for Vigilante 3, which looks freaking awesome. I'm going to talk for a minute because Rob's clearly got an issue and he's just a moron. I hope he agrees that it's, I hope you agree that it's illustrated gorgeously.
Yes,
I
mean, of course. Jerome King Moore's a great artist. Yeah.
Right. That what I'm laughing then we're on about. The same. Okay. You're probably laughing about the shoulder pads.
Yes.
The shoulder pads are ridiculous. Okay. Good but it's Lord. The 90s. It's the 90s. She's got tactical shoulder pads on, which are huge. And she's this tiny, super thin lady. So they look even 10 times bigger than they should. So she's wearing the same sort of costume that Adrian, Chase wore as Vigilante, just without the mask. She's just got red goggles on instead, blonde hair, stunning figure, gorgeous, sexy lady. You know, Jerome K. Moore makes her 10 times hotter than any woman deserves to be. Super sexy, wearing that outfit. And she's in the foreground standing on, looks like a railing. And in the background, you've got like some really amazing sort of Doric columns. You've got a cityscape. You see a little tiny Deathstroke in the background. You see a Black Hawk helicopter coming at you. She is essentially a Punisher type character in the DC universe. And, all right, let's talk art now. What do you think?
That's great artwork. Jerome K. Moore, terrific artist. Absolutely. The costume's ridiculous. Again, it's...
Well, get rid of the shoulder pads.
Well, right, it's still just over... I mean, look, yes. If you guess you get rid of the shoulder pads, it makes sense because she's the Vigilante. I didn't even know that this... I didn't know this character existed. There was a third Vigilante. I had no idea. Post-Peacemaker series. It's hard for me to kind of look at the Vigilante and not laugh because he's such a goofball.
Okay.
In the Peacemaker TV series. He's a complete lunatic sociopath. I had no idea who this was. So okay. That's a big gun she's holding in that inset though. I mean, that is a hand cannon.
Yes, it is. And on the wall behind her, it says Vig don't shiv. And I got to assume, Vig being Vigilante, I got to assume that's a reference to Dark Knight Returns, you know, kind of thing. Because didn't they
always Rob don't shiv.
Yeah. So I love that. So she was a cop whose partner was murdered by a hitman. And Deathstroke comes after the murderer. And she ends up running from the law herself. She gets in trouble. And she ends up receiving Adrian Chase's old costume. Puts it on. She becomes the new Vigilante. And at this point, she had been the Vigilante for about 10 months. And she ends up romantically tied with Deathstroke. And she's a reoccurring character in the series all the way to the end. So the series ran 60 issues. So she was Yeah, it did. So she is a reoccurring character for 60 issues, almost 60 issues. As not quite a partner, but kind of, again, romantic connection. She was doing her thing. He was doing his thing. You know, they bump into each other once in a while. And once the series ended, though, She still made a few appearances here and there, but not really as the Vigilante anymore. Because by 2005, DC had a new Vigilante, and it seems like they've got a new Vigilante every 5 minutes, including the Peacemaker thing. Like they always seem to have a new Vigilante at this point. But first of all, I liked that Deathstroke series a lot. I really, really did. I thought it was a great take on a DC Punisher type character. I loved seeing her in the series. Jerome K. Moore can draw a beautiful, incredibly sexy woman. Now, look at her pose in the front. her body language, that, am I imagining that looks kind of like a, not the drawing itself, but the pose? Is that kind of like a Nagel pose from the 80s to you?
I'm not really seeing that. I don't think of poses with Nagel because mostly he just did from like the shoulders up.
Okay.
So I don't really think about that. But yeah, no, it is not a action pose. It's a fashion model pose. It's not someone who runs around shooting guns and throwing knives at people kind of pose.
That's fair. Well, again, she right now Deathstroke is on issue number 19. So she'd been around as Vigilante at least for 10 months. She'd been around longer than that as the character, though. The writer on this entry was Mark Waid. The border is red for Hero, which, you know, could be kind of questionable because she's more like a Vigilante. So she's okay with killing people with that hand cannon. So is she a hero? Is she an anti-hero? I don't know. But I love the entry and I love that series. So it makes me happy.
Okay.
Up next is now we still have the Justice League map to talk about after this, but I don't consider that the final entry. This is the final entry.
Wow.
In DC Who's Who, right here. It is Willoughby Kipling.
Fan favorite. Willoughby Kipling.
You ready for this? TV star Willoughby.
Of course, because he's in the Doom Patrol. Of course, they worked everybody into that.
Played by none other than Mark Shepard. So
who's Mark Shepard?
Well, if you Google a picture of him, you'll go, oh, that guy. He's been in every franchise, every geek franchise ever. I mean, X-Files to Doctor Who to Firefly to Doom Patrol. I'm sure he's been in Star Trek and Star Wars. He must have been at some point. The guy's done every genre show ever, you know, since the 90s. Anyway, so Willoughby Kipling is basically a poor man's John Constantine. All right. So the rumor has it that Morrison wanted to use Constantine in Doom Patrol and he was told no. So he made up his own. I mean, the guy is British. He drinks too much. He smokes. He's sarcastic. He's a mystic. Gosh, it sure sounds a lot like John Constantine. So the gist of it is he comes from a rich family line who lost everything. So he ended up living as a homeless person, became very bitter, very sarcastic. In his 20s, he was recruited by the Knights Templar and ends up, you know, getting into magic and protecting mystical stuff and ends up partnering with the Doom Patrol on occasion. So, and the art here is by Stan Walk. So I like the art on the front of this quite a bit. He's standing on a street corner, leaning up against a pole. You know, there's a fence behind him that's all wooden and knotty and messy and there's trash on the ground and the logo looks like a billboard. I really like this entry.
Yeah, it's fine. I'm not like, wow, it's amazing, but it's suitably moody. And I like that they put his logo like as part of the background.
Mm-hmm.
That's a nice little detail.
Well, I mean, if you compare this though to like Dark Stars or something, I'll take this every day, all day long. Mm-hmm. So yeah. Now here is the thing that I haven't mentioned that has got to be mentioned, which is this entry is written by Grant Morrison himself. This is the only entry in all of Who's Who that is written by Grant Morrison. So put that together. Grant Morrison got to write the very last entry in Who's Who ever. I don't know whether that's fitting or poetic or tragic. I don't really know, but I feel like it means something. Like, you know, this was not supposed to be the last iteration of Who's Who ever. But maybe the power of Grant Morrison's mysticism killed Who's Who? I don't know. Help me out here.
You are going down a rabbit hole, sir. I think it's just random. It's just a random. It had to be somebody, and it just happened to be Grant Morrison.
Okay, fair enough. Well, people have been getting a lot of fun, a lot of play on this on social media when I posted that in the last day or two. So a lot of other people see some joy in this idea that he got to do the last Who's Who entry, which is just so strange, so strange. So, border is red for Hero. And, yeah, we already talked about it. The only thing again to note is that we're 1 month away from Doom Patrol becoming a Vertigo book. And it is at the time, this is Doom Patrol's, you know, final Grant Morrison issue on the shelves. So really, now that I think about it, if he wrote this entry after he wrote his last issue of Doom Patrol, is this the last Doom Patrol thing he wrote? Maybe. Okay. So not the last entry, but the last thing we're going to talk about here is the fold out map for Justice League America headquarters. And this is the Dan Jurgens Justice League headquarters that has replaced the embassies for JLI. So this is his new headquarters. So it's got your design of the headquarters building. It shows you some inset pictures of like ICE's room and some of the defense guns and the front door and some more defense guns and a meeting room table. And then you see, you get to see the bug, you know, Blue Beetle's bug, and you see Blue Beetle in like a lab of some sort. So, what you think?
It's nice. I mean, again, it's the location. I like all the insets of the various things. It reminds me of the JLA, the, you know, the original one where they saw, like, you know, pool for Aquaman, stuff like that. So I like the meeting room table. You know, yeah, it's, you know, pretty basic stuff. But it's nice, and I'm glad they did it.
Yeah. I'm glad it's here. It doesn't do a lot for me. I do like that Blue Beetle got a lab, because that sort of reminds you. That's one thing Dan Jurgens tried to bring back, is that, you know, Blue Beetle's a genius. You know, he is an inventor. So that gets ignored in JLI most of the time. So I'm glad he brought that back. Ice's quarters look incredibly generic, you know, like maybe she doesn't spend any time there. I don't know. One thing to note, the building sort of has an echoey feel to the UN building. Like, if you look at it with the elongated part here and the tall part there, I don't know. Do you see what I'm talking about? A little echo of the UN building?
Yeah, I get a little bit. I'm not that familiar with the UN building, but, you know, I mean, that would make sense.
Yeah. So ultimately, at the end of the day, I don't feel like this headquarter leaves an impression on me. Like, it doesn't. So unfortunately, like, the JLI embassy, I feel like I know in and out because it's just like a nice brownstone. But this just kind of, I don't know. It doesn't leave me flat.
Just kind of a building. Yeah.
I mean, it's fine. There's nothing wrong with it. It's absolutely serviceable. So,
it's no Hall of Justice or anything.
Right. And Jurgens did a nice job illustrating it. But I love, like, instead, like, the cutaways to the Secret Sanctuary. I'll take that every day instead. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right, Rob. So I ask you every time we do a Who's Who entry, and I guess I'm asking you for the last time of at least the DC Who's Who's, what are the best entries in this issue?
Let me think about this. I'm just jumping around. I like Thrust.
So messed up.
Hey, look, I finally like a Legion. Let me like a Legion, for God's sakes.
Someone in the comments, I think it was Damian Drew A. White, or I'm not sure, referred to Thrust as the most homoerotic entry in all of Who's Who. So,
all right, it's fine. Let's see. I mean, for pure drawing, Doomsday is great.
Yeah,
pure her draftsmanship. I mean, clearly my favorite's Justice Society. That's a gimme. I mean, come on. I like Lurker minus the cruddy logo. Ramona is fun because it's just so unique. And Thrust. I think those are my favorites.
Okay. That's fair. You're allowed to have an opinion and you can be wrong. Justice Society America, absolutely the best entry in the book. No doubt about that. I love the Ray entry. I agree it's a little too overdone. Maybe I'm just being biased because how much I like the Ray, but I love that one. I love the Vigilante 3 one. Shoulder pads excluded. I love that entry. I think it looks awesome. I also like Arion. I love the design and the backgrounds, you know. Bloodwind, I thought the costume design's great. And then Team Titans, as ridiculous as the characters might look, Kevin Maguire just drew the hell out of it. So
yeah, it's anything drawn by Kevin Maguire is, you know, very nice looking.
Yeah. So, all right, folks, that's it.
Wow.
Who 12 years it? In 12 years in the making.
We did it, everybody.
Again,
old star all around.
The show's not over, Frank. No, we're going to talk more about that in a minute. I should save that. But we've got a lot more to come, a lot more episodes to come. We're going to continue talking about some great stuff. So do not unsubscribe. Do not feel like we're done, because we're not, folks. We've got more to talk about in coming months and years.
We should absolutely just do the Impact and then never do another one.
That's not going to happen. Unless I Frank did ask this week for a new podcatcher recommendation. I wonder if I could hack his podcatcher and, like, after we do the Impact issue, and just unsubscribe him so he thinks that's the last episode. That would be the joy.
Who set me up for Stitcher? What's happening?
There's a timely joke.
There we go.
All right, folks. So we are going to take a quick podcast promo break. I have no idea how long we've been recording. I think it's been 8 hours. But anyway, we're going to take a podcast promo break. And when we come back, we're going to cover your feedback from Who's Who Update 93, issue number one.
Welcome to the world of tomorrow.
The Legion of Superheroes through the Silver Age, the Bronze Age, the Baxter series, 5 years later, the reboot, the three-boot, the retro-boot, the animated series. We have banded together as the Legion of Super Bloggers to cover it all. Seek us out at legionofsuperbloggers.blogspot.com.
Always have to say it that way.
Haven't you ever heard of a little thing called showmanship?
Hey,
Sean, do you want to go over the checklist to make sure we are ready for the next phase of the Batman family reunion?
Sure thing, Paul.
Robin and Batgirl in team-up action?
Check.
Fried chicken?
Check. Man-Bat fighting a rare jaguar?
Check.
Deviled eggs?
Check. Potato salad?
Check.
Without the raisins?
Of course.
The Huntress fighting Catwoman and Poison Ivy?
Check. Lemonade?
Check.
Alfred and Commissioner Gordon keeping a secret from Bruce Wayne?
Check and check. Reprints or all new stories?
New stories and reprints until issue 10, and then nothing but brand new stories from there on out. Giant-sized issues?
A mere giant size until issue 16, and then dollar comics from issue 17 to 20 through the end of the run in Detective. Guest list?
Absolutely. We are having a number of Bat relatives visit the reunion, so listen in for your favorite Bat cousin.
All right, great. Then we're all ready for the Batman Family Reunion podcast, where we talk about Batman Family, the great comic book from the 70s and 80s. We'll discuss not only the stories, but also the text pages and ads, and we'll also find out what the Batman family was doing on the newsstands that month.
And since this is a reunion, we're inviting all of you, the Bat kinfolk, to listen in and to be part of the show.
Look for the Batman Family Reunion podcast on the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
All right, folks, we're here for Who's Who, Hows, and Whys. This is your feedback from Who's Who Update 1993, issue number one. So you wrote this feedback a year ago, which is kind of cool because you probably don't remember what you wrote. So it's all new information to you, even if I'm reading your words. So that's fun. First up, iTunes reviews. As we always ask, please, please consider leaving an iTunes review if you haven't. We have quite a few, but we could always use a few more. Rob, you want to read this iTunes review for us?
Yeah, we got a new one from Alan Boyce, and it says, Reliving Childhood. I have been listening to all the episodes, enjoying almost every moment. I have laughed. I have cried from laughing. As others have said, listening to this podcast has caused my list of podcasts to grow. Now that I am at this point, I will eagerly await new episodes. Thank you, Rob and Shank. Well, thank you, Alan.
Sorry to make you wait so long, Alan. And folks, remember, if you leave an iTunes review, we will read the entire iTunes review on the air, because the rest of this, for the comments, we get a lot of comments on the Who's Who podcast. So much so that nowadays we don't read stuff from social media anymore. We just read the comments from our website and the iTunes reviews and the emails, and that's it. So if you want to get every word read, submit an iTunes review. Otherwise, what we're going to have to do is we're going to kind of cherry pick what to read from people's comments, because Rob and I have 38 pages of feedback here. We obviously can't read all of it. The stupid podcast is already long enough, right?
It's 3:15 in the morning, everybody.
Rob is surprisingly holding up well. So anyway, leave your comments on the website, and we will read parts of your comments there. Or if you want the whole thing, write an iTunes review. All right. First up comes a comment from Osamu Hideki Yukinori. Osamu, I'm pretty sure I slaughtered your last name there. However, I'm carrying on the grandiose tradition of mispronouncing your father's last name for many years before I finally got to know him. I would say his name wrong. So there you go. Osamu is, of course, the son of Who's Who podcast contributor, Zoom Yukinori. So Osamu, I don't know if you remember this, Rob, or not. Last episode, we talked about the Who's Who Omnibus. And I made a confession. I admitted that I had not bought the Who's Who Omnibus for the very reason that I already own all the issues of Who's Who. I own the physical copies. I own them digitally. I own them on Comixology. I own them on DC Universe. I have them a bunch of different ways. And I said, all right, look, first of all, I've already bought them several times. I don't want to buy them again. And if I bring an omnibus that big in the house, my wife will probably divorce me. So after I said that, Osamu took it upon himself to do a drawing. He drew Barney Rubble. Right? He drew Barney Rubble, but he actually did it as Rob. He like made him bald and gave him Rob's sort of blonde goatee and the Aquaman outfit. It's hysterical. It's Barney Rubble mailing a Who's Who omnibus to me. And he's using sort of that shtick he would use in the Fruity Pebbles commercials where he'd always be like, hey, I'm going to trick Fred out of his Fruity Pebbles. So it has Aqua Rob Barney Rubble saying, hey, watch me trick Shag out of his marriage.
I love it. I don't get the Barney Rubble. Like, I don't get why it's a Flintstones thing, but I don't care. It's very funny.
Just watch some commercials. Fruity Pebbles. I think they still do them.
You know, I guess it's the tagline, right? I do remember that tagline. So, okay.
Oh, my God. And the artistry is great. I mean, it looks exactly like Barney Rubble, but exactly like Rob and Aquaman at the same time. So, well done, Osamu. You're amazing. So good.
Fantastic. the imagination apple doesn't fall from the tree, as it were here. So, okay. We got a email. We got several emails actually from, someone named Kara Lovett, and they are very long and they're very detailed, and we really appreciated them. And so, as Shag mentioned, we can only read portions of them, but we definitely wanted to mention some of the things she said we thought was quite interesting. So she wrote, Rob and Shag, I'm writing in to say I have listened to almost all of Who's Who over the past few months. It is truly a fantastic podcast, and I loved every minute of it. Seeing that I've listened to a lot of podcasts, I have a lot of things to say, so I apologize if this email gets too long. See, Frank, you apologize at the beginning. That's all. That's all we need.
He may have apologized 12 years ago and we've forgotten, but
whatever. First up, my Who's Who origin. To be honest, I don't have one unless you count me buying the omnibus. Well, that counts. I was born about 5 years after the last issue of Who's Who hit the stands. We're so old. So there's no way I would have bought it new. What I did have, however, was the DK published Marvel and DC encyclopedias. My dad, my brother, and me got the first Marvel and DC encyclopedias when I was a kid. Soon after they came out, I would read it through cover to cover, reading all the entries, and it's how I know a lot about the history of both universes. Those first copies were what we read so much and so thoroughly that they started falling apart. Good news that around that time, the updated and expanded versions came out, so we got those. While I don't get the Marvel one anymore, I can say that personally, I have bought both the 2016 and 2021 DC encyclopedias from my own personal collection and still use them as reference and just to thumb through from time to time and read the entries of some of my favorite characters. My goodness.
And that's awesome. And those DC encyclopedias are nice. I have two of them myself, like the first one and then the first updated one. I don't remember the years on. I don't have the 2021 one, but they're gorgeous books. They're great. They really were the successor of Who's Who. And Kara went on to share, or sorry, Kara, I'm horrible at pronouncing things, by the way, but it is Kara, went on to share like examples of DC encyclopedia artwork that was reusing the original Who's Who artwork, which is really cool.
Like a scalp hunter, right? And stuff like that.
Yep.
Patrick Mann, things like that.
Kara also included her own drawing of a composite Aquaman Firestorm, which is amazing, by the way. I follow Kara on Twitter, and she's always posting really fun stuff, so you should definitely check her out there. Oh, there's more here. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
There's more. Yeah, like I said, she sent us the wonderful drawing of composite Aquaman, as he will be called, who is half Aquaman, half Firestorm.
What? Composite Aquastorm, thank you. Anyway.
What's composite Superman called?
Composite Super. From Superman and Man from Batman.
Sure. Anyway, she continues, my thoughts on the Legion. For most part, I agree with Rob. That's why I highlighted this paragraph. I have never been able to get into the Legion. I've tried a bunch of different titles and none of them catch my attention. I will say, however, that the coverage of Who's Who in the Legion really caught my attention and made me want to start reading some Legion stories.
Ooh.
I will say that five years later,
yeah,
looks bland, boring, and uninteresting. So I don't think I'll read that.
Boo!
Got it right on the first try, Kara. I will be checking out the Supergirl and the Legion stories when I get to that in my Supergirl reading project. Oh, Dr. Andrew, hear that? Also, from what I've seen of the Legionnaire series, both from the 93 update episode of yours and from the issues I've read in the crossovers, it looks very interesting, and I think I will look into it at some point. I know it was discussed a lot in the Who's Who and the Legion episodes, and as a queer woman myself, I was curious, when does the queer representation in the Legion stories switch from implied to explicit? I'd love to see representation in comics, and would love to see Ayla and Shrieking Violet's relationship especially. Also, while we're on the subject, I feel like when her powers changed to gravity-altering powers instead of Light Lass, her name should have been called Lightning Lass.
That's clever.
That's a great corny joke worthy of any of the kind of jokes we would be telling on the show in the last 12 years. Well done, Kara.
To answer your question as best as I can, when they went from explicit to showing the queer representations and relationships, I want to say that's the 5YL era. I'm pretty sure that's when Shrieking Violet was in a relationship with a woman. And then that's when, Element Lad. That was, it's hard to describe, but the Element Lad was with a woman who turned out to actually be a man. So they had a relationship, two men. So I'm pretty sure it was the 5YL era. So sorry, it may be bland and uninteresting, but appearance wise, but it's so stinking good.
And then she ends with, I look forward to new episodes, hopefully this decade, but take your time, Kara. Thank you very much.
It's possible Kara wrote this email 3 years ago, for all I know, given the frequency of our episodes. But anyway, thank you, Kara. And she, by the way, she posts Who's Who stuff not pretty often on her Twitter, so you should check it out. All right, then we heard from Patrick. Patrick, I'm sorry. Again, in the grand tradition of Who's Who, I'm going to mess up people's last names. Patrick Matinell, maybe? I'm not sure. Okay, so Patrick wrote, "Hey, Robin Shag, about 2 years ago, I was so happy to discover that Who's Who podcast existed. I spent a lot of time driving, so I relatively quickly blasted through the entire series. Who's Who was the first series I ever collected." Yeah, I know. Wow. I hope you find better things to do with your time nowadays. Anyway, Who's Who was the first series I ever collected, and I did so because it celebrated so many of the types of offbeat and obscure characters that I always felt more strongly drawn to. I was always found characters like Brother Power the Geek a lot more interesting than ones like Green Lantern. So I loved how Who's Who put all the DC characters on basically a level playing field." Yeah, that's a great observation, Patrick. It really did. I mean, that's why Rex the Wonder Dog to me always, I thought he was super important. Patrick goes on to say, "I love the podcast and how deep you guys are willing to dig into these characters and their histories, because I'm always catching up with old episodes and I never felt the need to write in, but with a couple newer episodes, I thought I'd chime in with some notes." Now, Patrick wrote an email, by the way. So again, it's fairly lengthy. I'm just picking out bits and pieces. He says, "I love the Who's That episodes. As a big fan of Charlton, I was especially excited about the most recent Nightshade one. I do have one bit of small information to add to their team history that you didn't mention, that in 1996, Nightshade popped up in Superboy and the Ravers, gosh, as part of a team with the very 90s name Intercept. Now, part of that's an acronym, short for Interdimensional Cooperative Enforcement Police Team. Goofy name for what I think is a pretty cool and surprisingly unused concept, a team that protects and is made up of beings from other dimensions." Okay, very cool. Well, thank you for listening to that episode. I think part of the reason that episode was so interesting was because Paul was on the episode and Rob wasn't. So then Who's Who in the new Golden Age.
Letting that go.
Right, you should. "I don't really read many new comics and wouldn't have even known this existed probably if not for your episode covering it. So thanks. It seems like such a fun way to expand on the Golden Age and build on the concepts of legacies that DC already handles so well. First up, I'm sure I won't be the only person writing in about Harlequin's son. The character was actually a Jerry Ordway designed character originally intended to be part of Infinity Inc." Yeah, I didn't know that. We did get lots of comments on that, by the way, but I did not realize that at the time we were covering it. So, and finally, I want to say thanks for putting out such great coverage and everything and anything that fits under the Who's Who concept. Oh, well, thank you, Patrick. Thanks so much for listening.
Absolutely. We got a message from Steve Givens from the It's a Givens blog, our pal Steve, who has actually been in this very studio that I'm recording this episode from. I don't know why Kelly let him in. Anyway, he says, gentlemen, have you forgotten already that I jovially called out Shag's pronunciation issues in my very first email to the network? I specifically mentioned him saying Monsieur Mala, because not only was it like nails on a chalkboard to my teacher ears, it also conjured up the uncomfortable images of a gorilla in priest robes serving communion with his feet. What can I say? It was at the height of the COVID-19 shutdown and my mind was playing strange tricks on me. Coincidentally, I recently got tutored on how to pronounce Monsieur the real Frenchy way by Siskoid in an appearance I make on his Who's Editing show.
I was laughing.
Oh, okay.
Something you don't hear very often, so.
This is the last episode. Do I ever give an acceptable French pronunciation, or does Siskoid scream and cry to hear me murdering his mother tongue? You'll have to listen to the episode to find out. As for this show, you guys have now ventured into an era of Who's Who of which I am not familiar. I don't even remember seeing this update series on my LCS back then. Admittedly, my comic book reading became very sporadic during this time as I was graduating high school and heading into my first year at college. I also just didn't have as strong an affinity for the loose leaf editions, raise his hand, as I did for the original series. The loose leaf Who's Who's always felt too rigid and formulaic with its entries, more like a gaming manual. The original series, on the other hand, had idiosyncrasies that were charming and made the issues a joy to read. Anyway, another great a bit long episode, guys. Thanks for keeping at it. Thank you, Steve.
Very nice, Steve. And yes, it does feel a bit like a gaming manual, which worked out perfectly when Mayfair Games did its Who's Who supplement that we will be covering at some point. Or we won't make Rob sit through that one, but we'll be covering the Mayfair Games Who's Who supplement on this very show at some point as well.
Followed by the Impact, which is the last episode.
It is not. But anyway, so yes, I said Monsignor Mala for years, right? No one bothered to say, dude, it's Monsieur, right? Steve's claiming he did, whatever. I don't believe him. He's a liar. He's a good chauffeur. I'll give him credit for that, though. He's driven me around a lot. So it's funny. This came up at HeroesCon just a couple weeks ago. Like we ended up bumping into people that listened to the shows who'd stop. Hey, are you Ryan Daly? Are you Shagging? You know, and stuff like that. Because, you know, we're super famous. But one of the things that came up was someone brought up the whole thing about Monsieur Mala and Monsignor Mala. And I'm like, oh, I can't get away from it. Oh, no. So if only I knew how to read. Anyway, then we heard from Rob McCarthy from the Hell on Wheels webcomic. And he talks specifically about Eclipso. And he says, I love the company-wide crossover. I think it's the best company-wide crossover ever. Why? Because it built into the plot a reason for all the heroes to fight people on their own level. You didn't end up with the usual, like, why the hell is Robin fighting Darkseid? That's a great point. You know, it really did, Rob, that gave them a chance to put in Superman versus Shazam. You know, got kind of that kind of power level. And yeah, it made a lot of sense. And I also have a soft spot for that crossover.
Al Gerding, known as the world's biggest Red B fan, which is a lot of competition for that, says,
hey, there is.
Yeah, exactly. I know.
I'm chasing his tail.
I'm making that joke to the exact wrong person who is actually someone else who likes Red B. He says, I hope this podcast lives forever. Eclipso killed my 80s Wildcat and Dr. Midnight, but they're back now and on TV. So suck it, Eclipso.
I love
reasonable.
Al.
Reasonable.
Al's awesome. I such a good guy. Good taste in ice cream, too, by the way.
Okay. Wow. Michael Bailey from the Fortress of Bailitude podcasting network, of course, friend of the network, writes to say he wrote comments about all the different characters, and we're just sort of cherry picking some of these. Regarding Mr. Z, Rob's reaction to these Superman characters is cracking me up, because to me, this all makes perfect sense, but I can see to someone who on the outside, it looks insane. Mr. Z was a cool supernatural type villain that has a first appearance, which is important to this era of Superman. Superman number 51 was the first book that had the triangle numbering system on it, 1991/1. That numbering would continue until 2002, and for fans of the era, it's a big deal. Right. Thank you, Michael.
Awesome. Then Michael wrote in about Lord Satanus. I had a lot to say about Lord Satanus last time, and I actually told Mike, I said, all right, time to write your TED talk here, Mike, about the scheme where Lord Satanus is the pre-crisis version is one letter different, and yet they're considered two completely different versions of the character. And Mike wrote in to say, Lord Satanus, I was today's years old when I realized that the pre- and post-crisis Satanus, had different spellings to their names. So yeah, this isn't the worst oversight I've made regarding this era of Superman, but it's close. I caught a Superman thing that Michael Bailey didn't. I need a plaque or something,
yeah,
for this.
That's weird, yeah.
Wow. And then he says, I took to Twitter to figure out the reason for this. Jerry Ordway was nice enough to give me this, to give this nerdy question some thought, and wrote, quote, I know we were not doing a continuation of the previous one as it was treated as a new character. So it's possible the spelling with a U just seemed cooler, like Janus versus Janus. You know, one had two faces. All right. Well, thank you, Jerry the Extraordinary Ordway. Wow. Then over Michael Kramer says, interesting thing about Abracadabra. Wally ran into him shortly after Invasion in issue 23 and described him as a stage magician who thought he was from the 64th century, implying that Kadabra wasn't just crazy as a bedbug. He was actually delusional about his own origins. I wonder if this was an attempt to keep Flash somewhat grounded by limiting his involvement with things like time travel. Interesting. Well, I do remember that back then there was kind of a moratorium on using the Flash rogues. So maybe that was part of, you know, like you said, trying to ground him. Interesting.
That's a fun idea, you know, to kind of keep it budget friendly, but have the flavor of the character.
Mm-hmm.
That's neat. Sean Ross from the Secret Wars and Beyond podcast and the Never Ending Reading Pile podcast and more says, did this episode prompt me to buy all 12 issues of the Hacker Files? Yes, it did. Am I a moron? Yes, I am. Great episode as always.
Well, you're a good company because Paul Keehan did the same exact thing, Sean. So listening to our episode. So that's fantastic. Awesome. I'm Hacker Files is surprisingly strong following thanks to us. So
we caused what they say is a bank run on Hacker Files.
Yep. I think James Gunn is working on the three movie series right now. So they are from Cisco. He's, of course, part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. He does shows such as Who's Editing, Oh Hot Me or Not, and more. He says about Agent Liberty, Shag having trouble talking about the costume in this episode. I get it. The Hot Squad is always teaching me new terms in that respect. In English, that crisscross is just called straps. That's it. I thought it would have been more involved because in French, it's the much fancier bandoliers. If anyone knows a more technical term, let us know. Well, Siskoid, I'm pretty sure we use the term bandolier as well. So, but thank you, because I couldn't come up with the language. So that was very helpful. And then he says about Black Condor, I said there was no connection to the Golden Age version. Siskoid corrected me, which I had forgotten about. There is a connection between this Black Condor and the Golden Age character who appeared as a ghost in some of the issues in the series, indirectly encouraging Ryan Kendall to become a crime fighter. Yeah, I had forgotten about that. So thank you, Siskoid.
All right. Matt Sirois from the TV Movie Rewind podcast is always happy to have a new episode of Who's Who to listen to. I've pre-ordered my copy of the upcoming Omnibus Volume 2 so I can listen once again with the actual book in my hands. Here's a suggestion for Rob. FW presents Tales from the Joe Kubert School. They say he's bringing it up. You can end every episode with a disclaimer. The story you've heard is just true. The names have been changed to protect the innocent. The guilty can twist in the wind. You know, I think I've told all the best stories. That's not stopping me from continually talking about it, but I don't know. Maybe there's more things that we did an episode of FW Presents a while back.
Yeah, it's probably like 7 years ago.
Probably. I did one with John Trumbull, who attended the Kubert School a little bit after me. And then I did a Pod Dylan with my pal Sean Tiffany, who was my roommate at Kubert. And so we were there all at the same time. And so there were some Kubert stories there, but you know, I don't know. There might be some other things worth recalling on episodes. So who knows, Matt, maybe.
That'd be fun. We also heard from Chris Franklin for the Firewater Podcast Network. He does shows such as JLU Cast, Superman Movie Minute, and more. He said about Black Mask, I talked about how I didn't have any background with Black Mask at all. So he says Black Mask was basically erased from continuity post-crisis until Doug Mensch came back to the Bat titles under Denny O'Neill. His initial storyline from the 80s was quite a bit darker than most Batman tales at the time. So it makes sense that he flourished in the 90s and onward. All right. Then he says, I'm not sure when I first read this information, but I knew that the character Yankee Doodle Dandy was, this was a Doom Patrol character we talked about last time, was actually an old unpublished Silver Age DC concept that Grant Morrison dug up and revived.
That's insane.
It makes perfect sense, though. But if the character had debuted in showcase number 50 from May 1964, as was planned, he would have beat the question to print by about 3 years. And he gives us a link that there was more on the Tom Brevoort blog. That's crazy. And then Chris goes on to talk a little about M.D. Bright's artwork. And I've said some things about M.D. Bright's artwork, about how it's serviceable, but not my favorite. Chris was kind of saying some similar things. And then Paul Keehan chimed in about, but then Mark Baker Wright pointed out something that blew my mind. Now, Mark Baker Wright is from the Not Your Father's Autobot podcast, also Black Rock's Toy Box blog. And Mark said that M.D. Bright did a cover for Transformers, specifically issue number 5. So, which is kind of, you know, Transformers, whatever. However, this is possibly the single, according to Mark, the single most iconic cover of the entire franchise. And when I looked at it, I was like, oh my God, I know that cover. I bought that issue because the cover is so striking. It's of this character Shockwave, and it says like all the Autobots are dead. And it's a painted cover. And it's now Chris points out that it's a very iconic cover. It's unlike anything else Mark Bright did or M.D. Bright did. But man, I've forgotten how amazing that cover is. So just to know that M.D. Bright did that, that's really, really cool.
Yeah, I remember that cover. Actually, I don't think I bought the book, but I do remember that cover.
I seriously doubt you bought a Transformers comic.
Probably not. David S. Gutierrez, owner and operator of the Katana Banana. Wow, he's continuing that joke. Says, my show is back. Thank you so much for that. And thanks for covering an issue I never picked up. It was released during my separation from comics, so I didn't even know of his existence for ages. Methinks the next time we get a show, Rob will officially be a K2. That is correct. Thank you again. Great episode as always. Yes, since the last time we did an episode.
Didn't think about that. Yeah.
I got married. Yeah, that's kind of amazing. I was also just going to point out, just as I was scrolling through these names, that, like, just in the last year, like, I've met some of these people for the first time, which was really cool. I got to meet Sean Ross and things like that. So this is super cool. This is fun seeing these names and realizing I got to hang with a lot of these people.
I've literally, sort of similarly, in the last year, I've hung out with so many of these people, whether it's a Heroes Con or Gallifrey, or they've been to my town, or I've been to their town. David S. Gutierrez, I hung out with him since the last episode we did. And just so many of these people I've gotten to know and spend a lot of time with now. And I love that I can call you guys friends. And Frank.
Michael Wagner says, miss Rob's political jokes. You're the only one, Michael. So many missed opportunities this episode. Did I miss the episode about the PG era starting? How many years will Shag beat a dead joke? Looking forward to the next episode in October.
Ironically, Michael, you were being funny saying the next episode in October. It took a lot longer than that. Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm. They were from Tom Panarese from the Pop Culture Affidavit blog. He says, I first spotted we talked a lot about Travis Cherris last time, and we did again this episode. He says, I first spotted Travis Cherris' artwork in the Flash annual that tied into Eclipse of the Darkness Within. Like Frank, I loved the Jim Lee look of it all, and I decided to hype up the guy to my friend in Florida by photocopying the Evil Star entry at my local library and mailing it to him along with my latest letter. Unfortunately, I left the entry sitting in the photocopier and didn't realize it until I got home and went to put it back in my binder. Oh, I reached back to the library on my bike and it was gone. Oh. So I have every issue of Who's Who Loose Leaf and updates except for the Evil Star entry. Oh, that's brutal. That is brutal, Tom. Now, remind me next time I see you, Tom, if you still haven't found a copy of that, I will give you mine. So, but you got to remind me because I'm going to forget.
Very nice. Dr. Ange from the Supergirl blog, Comic Books Commentary, and the Legion of Super Bloggers. He says, so happy to see the show back on the air. I won't bury the lead. I would rather have 10 Danny Chases than one Terry Long. Screw that guy. Wow. Ange is so gentle. And then you see that. Oh, my goodness. Anyway, he says on to some comments, and then he says he goes through some of the characters, and he says, Yankee Doodle Dandy. I said above, this was a character which existed prior, but it never made it to print. I haven't clicked the link, but I think the cover of Doom Patrol 51 was an homage to that unprinted story. That's amazing. Yes, he is completely bonkers, totally at home in the Morrison Doom Patrol. He ultimately defeats Mr. Nobody by ripping off one of those floating heads in space and throwing it onto Nobody. The face makes Nobody more real and thus killable. Dandy does him in. I don't understand any of that paragraph.
I sadly did.
Okay. Anyways, great to hear more Who's Who fun. I can't wait to hear more. Well, thank you, Ange. And I know you're already doing quite well, but get well soon, my friend.
Yeah, we're all thinking about you, buddy. Then we heard from Mike Atchison from Mike's Comic Shop Roadshow podcast. Here's another guy that I've now spent a whole weekend with and felt very, very close to now since the last time we recorded. So Mike says, all right, this gets a little inside baseball complicated, but on the previous episode in the feedback, we read a post from a guy named Eric, who talked a lot about the artists in Atlanta in the 90s all hanging out, including Tony Harris and Craig Hamilton and stuff like that. And there was a lot of speculation about these artists and who sort of did what. So Mike was confirming that, yes, in Tomorrow's Back Issue Magazine number 133, which is a Starman issue, Tony Harris did validate that all these artists hung out together and that they're studio mates, including Craig Hamilton, and that Craig Hamilton did sort of mentor him and help get him into comics. The interesting thing, though, was Mike says, I just finished the issue before listening to this episode. So it was a fascinating interview with both Robinson and Harris, and I highly recommend it. So, all right. Well, thank you, Mike. And great to see you, Mike. We really, really had a blast hanging out with you. They were from Liz Ann Oswald, who has her own YouTube channel. Liz talks about Agent Liberty and says that Agent Liberty is a great character that never really got his due. And his appearances on the Supergirl TV show were definitely not right. Kind of reminds me of a less weird version of Super Patriot from Savage Dragon, just without the cybernetics. Okay, interesting observation. This is great. Liz talks about Eclipso. Liz says, in the category of trying too hard, the award goes to Lord of the Decade, this version of Eclipso. I have no idea what to say about this. I am just glad it didn't last long. This looks like a very edgy kid worked out really, really hard till he was like 18 years old, then threw together a costume for a cosplay of Eclipso, but he wanted to make it cool, you know, like spelled all funny. And it took way too far. And this person took it way too far, you know, because, you know, Eclipso is all crazed out, right? So the idea is that this cosplay just went nuts. Because then Liz goes on to point out, doesn't Eclipso have all sorts of powers with their stone? Why does he need a sword and a dagger? You know, and for all this goth punk stuff he's wearing, why is he wearing spurs? Just a lot of stuff that I took for granted, Liz, you kind of pointed out. And I'm like, yeah, okay. She makes a good point. All right.
Okay. Noah Tarnell from the Big Quiz Thing. By the way, another person I got to meet in the last year. Kelly and I had dinner with him when we were out in San Francisco. It was just wonderful. He says, oh, happy day, the return of Who's Who. Okay. So Shag has never heard of New Jersey's Pine Barrens. Correct. Clearly, he's never watched The Sopranos, whose by consensus greatest episode is titled Pine Barrens and mostly takes place in said woodsy expanse. As for a similar lack of knowledge about the Jersey Devil, clearly he's not an NHL fan either. But while I, like Rob, spent my formative years in New Jersey and even recall learning about the Devil in elementary school, I've encountered two fellow New Jersey natives who somehow have never heard of the creature. For shame. I spent years looking at that thing. Well, years staring out the window of the car as my family drove down the highways in New Jersey. No luck.
Then Noah says, my main memory of Valar is that when he guest starred in an issue of the Will Payton Starman series, it was essentially a comedy issue. They encountered each other and through a series of misunderstandings end up fighting. I still recall what set it off. Will Payton says something innocuous in English, but whatever it is, it sounds like in Interlac, which is Valor's language, your mother lusts for my throbbing studliness. Hijinks and battle ensue. That Will Payton series was so good.
And then he says, regarding Starbreaker, Rob, you're going to hate this, but in the Dan Jurgens JLA story that brought him back, Superman says something like, the old league first encountered him one of the few times I joined them for a mission. Yeah, he's right. I do hate it. Remember, this was back in the days when Superman was retconned into being only an honorary member of the original JLA. Starbreaker also says something to the effect of, this is the Justice League? Where's your Green Lantern? I like that. The idea that the JLA has a certain cachet for intergalactic beings because they have a member of the JL Corps in their ranks. he could also have said, where's your Thanagarian warrior? Maybe he did. Or maybe Hawk continuity was too tangled for that at the time.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. You're completely right. I hate all that.
I like Superman, not in the Justice League. That's just made up. All right. Then you get Martin Gray from the Too Dangerous for a Girl blog. Martin gave a lot of rapid fire stuff, so I'm just going to read some of the comments here. Azrael, I couldn't describe Azrael's costume if my life depended on it. What a monstrosity. Rubbish character, too. Then Count Viper, which was a Hawkman supporting character, Hawk World supporting character. I don't know who this guy is at all, but he's sexy as hell. See also Yankee Doodle Dandy, a definitive hot. Then the Hacker Files. I think Hacker Files writer Lewis Shiner also did some of the Wild Cards short stories. I ordered the Hacker Files series a couple of years ago from eBay. It's sitting under a bed somewhere unread. Aw. Then Lady Jane. I had completely forgotten about this character, but once you began chatting about her, it came back flooding back to me. DC should bring her back. I mainly highlighted that one because I think that may be the only time anyone commented on Lady Jane in 30 years. So I had to bring that up. Then he says, Mr. Z and the Time and Time Again storyline was fab, which is absolutely true. It was. And he says, the best entry art-wise was definitely Black Mask, which was a vote in your favor because you were really big on the Black Mask entry. So there you go.
I was. Absolutely. I still really like that character. And he was in that movie. He was in the Birds of Prey movie.
Harlequin Birds of Prey movie.
The Harlequin movie, which I, whatever, but still. Anyway, Max Traver from the Weird Warriors podcast is a great episode, of course, and just awesome to have the show back in general. Now that I'm kind of part of a podcast, I look at this glorious 3-hour plus runtime and just have to wonder, how long did that take to edit? Of course, it's likely that neither Rob nor Shag constantly sniff like a low-rent Scarface as I do, so that probably saves time. There are many great comments already, so all I have to say is that this episode left me with a strong desire to reread the post-Zero Hour Legion.
Woohoo!
Thanks, as always, for an excellent show. P.S. I know it's mostly a gag, but I never tire of hearing Rob tell Joe Kubert school stories. Thank you, Max.
You went to the Joe Kubert school?
Ah, yes. And Paul Kien from our very network. By the way, while you guys were at HeroesCon, Paul and I had our own South Jersey Comic-Con, which was just the two of us. But nevertheless, it counts as a con because it was two of us. And we went to a comic store and everything. He actually took me to a comic store that I didn't know existed, that is only five minutes away from the house.
Wait, minutes away from where you live and you didn't know it existed?
Yeah. I didn't, it's not like I get like news bulletins. Hey, new comic shop is opened.
Right.
You know what I mean? I didn't know. And it's tucked. It's off the main road. So like you won't drive by it and see it. Okay. But yeah, he took me there and I bought some back issues. It was fantastic. It's a great little store. Anyway, thank you, Paul. Anyway, his comments, and of course, he co-hosts Batman Family Reunion here on the network. He says, left a couple of responses above. Just want to add that it was great to get another episode of Who's Who. The podcast had made me a podcast fan and now an amateur podcaster. Thanks, guys.
Again, I keep saying it. Who's Who is the show that built the network. And that's a perfect example. We wouldn't have Paul in the family now if it hadn't been for the Who's Who podcast. Yep. So we're better for it. So
absolutely.
And he was on the Who's That with Nightshade. So then, Damian Drew A. Whiter from the Should I Love This Comic podcast had lots of information. He's always got the info drop. It's just brilliant stuff. Here's Azrael. Coincidentally, I was rereading the second Nightfall trade yesterday and I came to two realizations. First is that Joe Parra is an unsung genius. The man could draw anything and do it well. But the second takeaway was that the problem with Azbats is that neither Azrael nor Bane feel real. Everyone around them feels right and gets to shine, but they just come across as plot points. Ultimately, no matter how great a costume designer Joe Quesada is, the costume is empty. Wow. That's some deep stuff right there. All right. I have to think that through, but yeah, I nothing immediately is contradicting that in my head. And Cerberus, this is a great illustration to go with a pretty lame villain. This is the one you got all excited about. It's the big gray blob with like who puts bottled heads on top of it.
You kind of like him.
Great illustration to go with a pretty lame villain. This is the epitome of Who's Who. A great entry can make any old mort seem like a great, seem great. And John Bogdanov was really bringing it. So yeah, it's a great entry for just a, oh man, just such a ridiculous thing. Anyway, Green Lantern Corps. I never really liked these guys. In fact, it was an expansion of the core that I dropped this version of Green Lantern. I always felt to me like they launched the Green Lantern series with one idea. I'm talking about this is the one in the 90s. They launched the Green Lantern series with one idea, which they played out over the first 8 issues, and then just tread water until Ron Mars came along with Kyle Rayner. Great image by MD Bright, though. Boy, Damian, let me tell you, you just summed up something I have been trying to articulate for years. That Green Lantern series was so frustrating to me because it started great, just like you said, the first 8 issues, and the rest of it was so boring. It was horribly boring. In fact, I dropped the book right before Kyle Rayner came on because I was so bored with it. And then Kyle Rayner came on, so I came back on the book. But yeah, you summed it up perfectly. Yeah, first 8 issues. Yep. All right, then about Legionnaires. These Chris Sprouse designs are amazing, and the beer bombs were at their best on Legionnaires. Such a shame that the team was set up to be so short-lived. Yeah, all right, so the Legionnaire books come out, and they get, what, 2 years, 3 years before Zero Hour wipes them from existence? That was a shame. Timberwolf. How did this end up being the most homoerotic entry in the history of Who's Who? I presume it's at least in part to Joe Phillips' ability to draw anything sexy. It's like his superpower. Of course, I'm lying about this being the most homoerotic Who's Who entry. That's coming next episode with the same creative team. Who needs to write slash fiction when Timberwolf is fighting Thrust?
Ah, oh, there we go.
That's what I was referencing earlier.
I was like, where's he going with this? Okay, got it.
Love it. Thank you.
Mike Dinah says, extreme! I would yell that louder, but it's very late and my wife's asleep. Ahem. Okay, know that now that I have that out of my system, it's good to have Who's Who back. The banter between you two is the best, and it makes me happy every time you guys get together for an episode. You gentlemen are the reason I started listening to podcasts on the regular.
Wow.
Who's Who? Wow. We're not legally responsible, Mike. Who's Who has been, Who's Who has been with me low these many years. And while I'm super excited to see another episode drop, I feel like we are coming to the breakdowns era of the show. To mix my podcast metaphors. But until the end, I'll just enjoy what's right in front of me.
Right. So the beauty is, yes, we're going to cover, you know, the stuff that came, or, well, actually, technically, Impact was already out, but we're still going to do a lot of stuff that takes place earlier in Who's Who. So we're not in breakdowns. We have the ability to, like the linear men, Rob, we can travel up and down the timeline of Who's Who and do whatever we want.
Mm-hmm. We have an idea that involves us ripping someone off who ripped us off.
Oh. Which was a ripoff of, well, anyway, there's a lot of ripping off going on in that chain.
We're going to be incepting the show for many years. So he continues, he says, I was intrigued by Rob's view on prequels, specifically about the new world of Krypton. While I certainly can see his side, to me, all that extra content makes the main story more interesting to me. It's why I love reading the Star Wars novels and comics so much. It makes Luke's journey seem even more special that he overcame all this history to rise above everything else. But, big but, I do think it can go too far. One of my few pet peeves about all this extra content is when they keep making series as opposed to occur between two very specific points in time. To use the Star Wars analogy again, there's only so much that can happen between Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back, so please stop making stories that occur during that time. It makes it seem like they're having some world-altering crisis every 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah. As always, you guys are fantastic, and I loved every minute, all 200 minutes of it. It almost took me the same amount of time going through all the comments as well, mostly because of Frank. I'm looking forward for whatever or whomever comes next. Keep up the great work. Well, thank you, Mike.
Woohoo!
And then Tim Price from the Outcasters podcast from the Batman Outsider show. He says, I was reading so many DC comics during this era. I knew all these characters. Favorites have to be the Heckler, too short-lived a series, and the Legionnaires, a fantastic era for the LSH. Interesting note, I just reached Starbreaker's debut last week in my 2022 JLA A Day reading project. Of course, by the time you read this, I might have finished volume 1, but still a crazy coincidence for me. Thank you, Tim. Well,
ironically, he finished the entire JLA A Day project, and now he's on from bow to stern, doing a Roger Stern project for 2023, which is great. Then we hear from Symbol Pending from the Power Girl blog, which is called Symbol Pending. They say all of the Netherworld stuff, so this is the Hawkworld stuff, all the Netherworld stuff reminds me a lot of the Wild Cards books, which were edited by J.R.R. Martin. As they started in 1987, I wonder if they had some influence. Well, then Nicholas Alheim, who's the author of superhero novels, writes in to say, between Lewis Shiner getting DC work and the obvious Joker Town / Netherworld parallels, I expect a lot of love for Wild Cards at DC. Yeah, probably.
Right.
If you're not familiar with Wild Cards, it's an anthology novel series about superheroes. We're checking out.
Mm-hmm. Ian Fletcher writes in to say, while writing this response, I went to a DC wiki to look up the list of characters in this issue again. I listened to the episode a few days back and had ideas of the few comments I'd wanted to make, but the wiki helps me recall the ideas I had by looking at the characters in the issue. Hilariously, when I got to Yankee Doodle Dandy, I pulled up his wiki page. The entry consisted of his name and this sentence: Yankee Doodle Dandy was a deranged government operative. That made me laugh out loud. But back to the comment. There are a number of DC characters that riff on Americana that, as a non-American, just always fall flat. Canada itself is nearly devoid of fictional characters and concepts we cling to, but now I'm picturing making a strapping hero called the Log Driver, which happens to be good at waltzing. This made me think of how, in the Reign of the Superman plotline, the Steel character's intended similarity to John Henry were completely lost in myself and my friends, but we did think he was cool. Since then, I've gone on to be more interested in some of these American folklore heroes, thanks to American Gods, as well as a growing interest in history. But Yankee Doodle Dandy is just such a weird character name for a non-American. It would be as if, were he Canadian in origin, this oddball would be named Upper Canada Man or something else, referring to the War of 1812. Shag and Rob love the show and look forward to the next episode. Thank you very much, Ian.
Well, I am. My heart is a little broken, Ian, that you don't have like a strong patriotic love for Alpha Flight. I'm just saying. But anyway. Then we heard from Diablo Frank, from the World Spine Podcast Network. He's doing shows currently like Dark Horses Presents Aliens and so many more. Frank writes a dissertation that is 3,251 words.
Okay? It's almost daylight, Shag. Let's get going.
I'm not reading all this thing, but he starts it off. This is great. University of Houston, Office of Research and Graduate Studies, thesis on the impact of Ending the Fire and Water Podcast presents Who's Who, the Definitive Director of the DC Universe, Expanded Universe of Podcasts by covering the MLJ Archie Red Circle Publishing Group's Assorted Heroes as part of a short-lived failed licensing imprint spanning less than 2 full years. So what he's done is he's crafted a fake thesis paper, like a doctoral thesis paper about why we should not end this show on impact. I mean, it's literally insane. And I love you for it, man. I absolutely love you for this. There's so many curse words I want to say right now. He writes a lot of comments on characters and stuff too. So I'll read out a couple here about Black Condor. He says, Black Condor suffers from Hawkmanism. I always approached Hawkman from the outside as DC's Wolverine, but he was obviously a more staid Fox Schwartz sci-fi space comic. Then the new 90s Black Condor is solicited brandishing a knife in taloned hands while topless wearing leather. I made a point of buying the first issue. Turns out he's just a jumped up park ranger. He just flies around and solves minor problems in rural Pennsylvania in a fairly gentle Silver Age pastiche. It's like selling me the Lizard King and delivering John Denver. It's like DC's dime bag of oregano. God, I love it.
I do like DC's dime bag of oregano. That's pretty good. He says, I missed Rob's criticism of the Black Condor logo earlier. I like it overall, but now that he's pointed out the two different fonts, I agree that they need to pick one. And then he says, he goes D4EF, you know, he does all these things.
Oh yeah.
I never had a use for Black Mask. Aside from the bogey illusion in the art here, he just seems like a generic mobster in Batman terms. I really just liked Mandrake on Batman. When they brought him back as the Red Skull crossed with Kingpin, that's all I saw. To each his own, Frank. I really love Tom Mandrake, and I just, those first two stories of Black Mask, I thought were so film noir and moody and weird that I always liked the character. I can't say I've read much about him since, but those first two really left an impression.
Maybe I need to go read those first two, because again, I've got no love for the character either. Mainly it's because I had very little exposure to him until, again, as Frank described him, you know, he's just another generic mobster. So maybe I need to read those first two stories. Frank then goes on to say, again, about the impact stuff, he says, just remember, kids, we're only doing this one more time. He's talking about this episode. I'll still be here for impact, probably to a greatly diminished degree. Afterwards, though, I don't really see any more manifestos in my future. Quote, you won't have Nixon to kick around anymore. End quote. Individual feelings of relief may vary. Oh, come on, Frank. You know, we're going to find something. You're going to be shocked at the stuff Rob and I are going to talk about, and you're going to find reasons to share. Now, it's not going to be a big laundry list like this. We're going to have stuff worth talking about.
Frank, I think of you as the Bob Haldeman of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, not Nixon, but okay. And then Isamu returns to respond, and he says, I have the suspicion that Uncle Frank does not believe that Uncles Rob and Shag's claim that they will not end this podcast series with the Impact Edition, even without the mounting evidence of multiple postings that can fill a dozen of Uncle Frank's dissertations suggesting that. On a related note, I like the Impact Jaguar series and look forward to Uncle's Rob and Jag's coverage of her entry. Okay.
We've got a plan. We do. Oh. And I think we've got a pretty good plan on how to cover Impact. So I think everyone's going to like it. Mm-hmm. So Siskoid also chimes in. He says, your thesis makes certain assumptions. And there's other points here, but he says, your assumption is that Who's Who show has only ever covered DC Universe characters, at which point I remind the listenership of the two Who's Who in Star Trek episodes. Yes. So we had two episodes about Who's Who in Star Trek. So we have mm-hmm. gone beyond the DC Universe. Mm-hmm. Frank responds by saying, oh God, I'm going to try and keep it together. He says, Who's Who is Robin Shagg doing DC? That Star Trek thing was heresy. I downloaded the MP3 onto a flash drive and burned it in a wicker amazing man to protect you from the specter. Sorry. Protect you from the specter's righteous fury at the sacrilege. Recant.
I really do enjoy wicker amazing man. That's a great kind of portmanteau there. Well done, Frank.
Oh, my God. Oh.
Jesus Christ.
I adore you, Frank, so much. All right. Then we have from Bradley Glenn, who goes, after who knows how many months, I finally caught up on your Who's Who episodes. Thank you for many hours of listening enjoyment at work. Your friendly banter. He must have meant to send this to someone else. I don't know. Anyway,
he's listening to one you and Paul did.
Oh, right, right. Okay. So it says, your friendly banter, comic life stories, personal perspectives, and infectious enthusiasm of DC Comics history is appreciated. He says, here's my Who's Who origin story. After starting my comics buying addiction, hobby, in 1991, I vaguely remember seeing some of the loose leaf editions as they came out. But I never bought any because of the seemingly ridiculous price and the fact that they featured many characters that were unknown or uninteresting to me. Listening to your coverage of the original 26-issue series inspired me to buy the 4 issues from that run that showcased some of my favorite classic characters. Adam Strange, Jonah Hex, Sergeant Rock, and Easy Company. And these issues are welcome additions to my collection. Wow, Bradley, that is an awesome origin. I'm so glad that we played a part in your love of this and having you go buy those 4 particular issues. That's really cool.
Yeah, that is super cool.
All right, folks, this is the part where we are going to thank all the people that shared our show on their social media. You know, it's going to sound like a long list of names. I get that. But we want to recognize each person that helped promote the show. And each one of you folks are an important part of the Who's Who community. Now, I have to apologize. I know I am missing some people here because it is surprisingly difficult to identify year plus old tweets and shares from Facebook and Twitter, especially for the chaotic last 12 months Twitter has had. So I am missing a lot of names, but I did my best, folks. So please, if we didn't get mentioned, you know, let us know and we'll make sure to mention you on the next episode covering whatever topic that might be. So, all right. Our thanks to A World on Fire, an All-Star Squadron podcast. All New Sucks, Asbats, Between the Pages blog, Captain Freakout Psychedelic Radio, Chris Franklin, Chris Lewis, Chris Lydon, Chuck Rodriguez, Cindy Womack, Coffee and Comics and their Days of High Adventure podcast and Fan Films Friday podcast, Damian Drew A. Whiter, David Ace Gutierrez, Devil Flyer Momentum, Diablo Frank and his Rolled Spine podcast, Dr. Ange, Dr. Pop Culture, Bowling Green State University, Ed Moore, Into the Weird, Usamu Yukinori, J. Jones Goldstein, Jacob at Stalic the Hero, Jeff Weinberg, Joe Tonello, John K. Mulder, Justice at X-Files 1969, Justice Trek, Kara Lovett, I'm sorry, it's Kara Lovett. See, I told you I'm not going to get that right. Keechee Baker and his Sports and Comics handle.
Leviathanai? I don't know how you say that, I'm sorry. Liz Ann Oswald, Lord Azoth, Martin Gray, Mason Holden 5, Matthew Barton, Max Romero, Mega Wubba 89, Metahuman Hunter 60, Michael Bailey, Michael Kramer, Michael O'Brien, Mick Jameson, Mike Dinas, Paul Kien, Prairie Justice, and Greg Sanders Vigilante Podcast.
Woohoo!
I sound like Zoom there. Relatively Geeky Podcast Network, Retro Cabal, Roger Preeb, Scott X, Secret Wars and Beyond Podcast, Siskoid, Stella at Batgirl to Oracle, Steve Givens, Superman Always, Symbol Pending, The Bat Pod, Tim Price, Warlock Thanos Podcast, Willie Yarborough, and Zeb Oswalt.
Woof, man. What an incredible long list of names. And thank you all for sharing and retweeting. Again, all you got to do is share on Facebook or retweet on Twitter, and we will do our best to say your name on the next show, assuming Twitter doesn't go down in flames like it all seems like it's going to do every day. So remember
on Mastodon, everybody.
Right. Counter-social. Remember, folks, go out to our website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. We will post a few of the images from this issue, or go out and buy that omnibus. You can see it all. So, Rob, next time.
Impact.
I don't know. Is it?
We'll work that out.
We'll have to figure it out, whether it's a Who's That, an Impact, something else special. Again, lots and lots of plans to keep the show going. So don't worry. This feed will, you'll get a handful of episodes every year. We promise. So.
And well, the thing is, one of the plans that Shag and I have is that the things that we are talking about doing will not be 4 hour long monster records, which means ideally we may be able to do them a little more frequently. Part of the reason that the show got so spaced out is because these records just got so massive. It was hard to schedule them. But if we have some ideas that might not be quite so daunting. And so hopefully we can get back to the show with some, you know, slightly more regularity. Cause like, you know, a year between episodes is absurd.
Again, we gave you 4 episodes last year, but yes, it between actual, whatever you want to call the flagship of the Who's Who show, I guess. A little inside baseball, since you guys are still here in hour 7. I've been pushing to do this episode for months. And every time we get a date, Rob like reaches out to me a week or two before. Can we move that to the following mm-hmm. month? Can mm-hmm. we move that? I mean, this thing was going to be another month later. I'm like, no, I'm standing my ground. We are doing this damn episode. And here we are. We did it. And it's been a hell of a mission. And I'm glad you've been there with me, buddy.
Absolutely. Well, okay. Before we sign off, I do have one thought I want to add, if you don't mind, Shag.
We're ending the network here right now.
This is going forever. We're handing it over to Paul and Sean. So one of the things that I learned from doing the Who's Who show, all however many episodes we've done at this point, is, you know, going through the original series and then the updates and then the other update and then the other update, you know, and then eventually this version. Is I had forgotten how much my fandom for DC Comics and comics in general, especially superhero comics, really hit a wall in the early 90s. Yeah. I don't remember it being quite so severe, but looking at these characters, I was like, wow, the original Who's Who series is so beloved to me. And I have all 26 issues still here in a box. And it's just one of my most favorite comics ever published, which is why we spend so much time doing the show. But as we go through the updates, there's more and more characters appearing where I'm like, I don't care. Who's that? I don't even care. You know what I mean? And then by the time we get to this iteration, I am tuned out. I'm just like 90% of the characters. Like, I don't care. They look stupid. I have no interest. But we know it was a gag that I don't read the entries, that I tend to look things on a more visual level. And that was funny, right? And it was, but the reason I was able to do that is because Shag did all the heavy lifting, everybody. Okay. All the character stuff, all the details that he was reading in this episode and other episodes, that was all him. And that allowed me to be kind of just the other guy going, oh, I don't like this. Let's move on. That would not be a great show if it was just two people doing that. That would be kind of sucky. So we needed that balance of one person who was actually engaging with this material and taking it seriously as much as we could. And that allowed me to be able to be like, oh, okay, whatever, you know, okay, Legion dot, whatever. I don't care. So Shag deserves a lot of credit for all that heavy lifting because he did all that tedious work. A lot of it, you knew a lot of it because your era of comics is much more that period than mine.
Yeah. Yeah.
But nevertheless, you still did all that work that I didn't have to do. And I appreciate that. And that made the show better. So thank you.
Well, since we're paying compliments to each other, again, we're now on hour 8, so no one's even listening anymore, so it doesn't do me any harm to tell you
how much I appreciate it. Frank's listening, but that's it.
Well, yeah. The show and the network wouldn't have existed if Rob didn't keep the schedule going. Cause time has proven when I try and do a show on my own, I stop doing it after a while. Like time becomes my enemy. Life gets in the way. The Ultraverse Network's a great example of, you know, stuff falling apart around me because I just couldn't keep it up. And you pushed us every month, especially in the early days, to get another show out. I'd be like, oh, we could go a week or two without a show. And you're like, no, we're going to have a show every week. And that's down to you. And you did the editing, which there's no way I could have got done. And you kept the machine rolling. And your art insight is so incredibly valuable to the show. Cause I'm like, I like pretty pictures. And you're like, well, no, look at the foreshortening. Look at that. And you did it a bunch today where you talked about stuff I wouldn't even thought of. And, you've been an incredible podcast partner for the last 12 years. I'm glad it's over. I mean, good Lord, I'm done with you.
Yeah.
But no, it's been an incredible journey. And I forget, you and I record together, if we're lucky, once every other month. probably nowadays, mm-hmm. I would say. Mm-hmm. And I forget how much I enjoy it. Like leading up to it, I'm just like dreading it. I'm like telling my wife, oh God, I got to record with Rob again. But you know, oh, I wish this could just stop. But then it's always so much fun. I have such a great time. Like folks, you know, like Rob said, it's 3 a.m. right now, right? But that's part of the fault is that we spent almost an hour just chit chatting on the front end because, you know, we're friends and we haven't had a chance to talk like that in forever. And I appreciate you as a friend, as a partner, as part of this community, and the one who really, you give me credit for a lot of the work of what I did on the show. But I mean, I got to throw it right back at you. It was your idea to even talk about Who's Who. You're the one who suggested we should do it.
What an insane idea that was
12 years ago.
And the idea that it's all going to end with Impact is just it just seems crazy.
It's not the ending. Stop. You're just feeding Frank. You know, he's, gosh. Anyway, folks, so the next episode will come out when it comes out. It's going to be something fun. We don't know yet because we now have the freedom, again, to pick anything from the sliding timeline. We've also got some other cool ideas that Rob and I have been tossing around about trying to do some other ideas with Who's Who that could be fun. But I don't want to mm-hmm. say what it is yet till mm-hmm. we, you know, mm-hmm. kind of that begins to come together. But this podcast is going to keep going. So with that, Rob, again, go out, folks, leave your comments on the website, go on the social media, you know, FW podcast, you know all that. I don't need to say it again. I think that's it. And so with that, let's just say it, you know, Rob, who's next?
Well, you didn't do your wave. You didn't what? Until next time. You didn't say that part.
Okay. I've only been doing it in 12 years. You think I knew what I was doing. All right. Until next time.
Who's next? Next.
Never matches up. Never. Not once.
Not once in 12 years.
Aquaman and Superman, Animal Man and Plastic Man, Firestorm and Nuclear Man, Batman and Hawkman, 2D Man and Hour Man.
Who are all these people, man?
They're all part of the DC Who's Who. Ultra Boy and Booster Gold, Lightning Lass and Hippolyta, Phantom Stranger, Etrick and Arisia and Woody Winks.
Hey, hey, hey.
What?
What about that one guy?
What guy?
Mr. Pretzel, Mr. Lipstick, Mr. Mitzelfuzzle?
Mr. Mitzi's Pitlick?
Yeah, him.
He's also part of the DC Who's Who.
Aw, man. We forgot Slipknot.
And we've been talking about doing this Who's Who podcast for a long time. So we decided the best way to do is just jump in.
Before Shag moves on, I want to mention something. I made a bet with Shag that as niche as our original show, the Fire and Water podcast, is, this show is even nicher. So Shag believes this podcast has a chance of being even more popular than the Fire and Water, and I say he's crazy. So we will find out within a couple of episodes vis-a-vis how many downloads each show gets, whether Shag is right or I'm right. If I'm wrong, I will admit it on the show, but I don't think I am.